Good at that. Alex taught me, Ellie said, eyes fixed to her task. Ever since they'd left, the little girl spoke to him only when necessary. He hadn't pressed. He was stunned enough she and Jaden had insisted on coming, although Jaden's rationale he half understood and even agreed with.
It's not just you. I knew Lena before you did, and I don't know if I can stay with Hannah now anyway.
Ellie, on the other hand, had simply refused to budge.
It's my choice.
No other explanation. At that, Hannah had been ready to spit nails, but what could she or Chris say?
How many more days until Rule?
Ellie asked. If we keep pushing, 2, no more than 3, especially if the weather holds.
Are you going to kill her?
He knew who she meant. If we see her. That was the idea behind leaving.
I don't know if you should. Shoot Lena, I mean. She still feels different.
Why do you say that?
Because I was really close twice and got a good look at her face. You know how the people eaters get that hungry stare, like they're totally starving and you're a hot dog? She wasn't all the way like that. Her eyes also seemed...
He watched her think of the right word.
Sorry. Like my dad when he went back to Iraq. It was his job. He had no choice. I think Lena's the same way. She's stuck.
If she can't help herself, it doesn't matter. It's not like she's sick and we can wait for her to snap out of it. We don't know if that will ever happen. It wouldn't be right to let her go and keep hurting, killing other people. Or being miserable either, although that was wishful thinking. The Lena he'd seen was wild, and she never came in his dreams as anything else. But what is Peter?
What if she can, Ellie said, stop herself?
That's an experiment we can't run, Ellie.
Okay.
The little girl's face closed. Reaching into a parka pocket, Ellie pulled out a small plastic container and unscrewed the cap. The contents, gooey and thick, reeked of turpentine. This was the most she'd spoken to him in days. Hoping to get her going again, Chris asked,
Did Alex teach you to do that, too?
Yeah. I found a good tree not too far away.
She used a stick to scoop out a nickel-sized dollop of pine resin.
Don't try to make knives. I'm not talking to you.
Okay.
Standing, he worked cramps from his legs.
How long did you sleep?
Enough.
She scraped a flint over a tangle of cedar fuzz and pine needles. A shower of sparks jumped. Cupping the tinder, Ellie blew until a yellow flower blossomed, then slid the bundle beneath loosely laid twigs.
Is Peter, like, a best friend or something?
Yes.
There was something hypnotic about watching a fire spread.
Best friend I ever had.
You know him a long time?
No, but it feels like it.
Are you worried that he's dead?
It was a strange question.
How come you're asking?
Still not looking at him, she moved a single shoulder.
Because I don't think you're sure. You asked him just now in your sleep.
It was a dream.
Maybe. But when you were sick, I sat with you sometimes. You talked to Peter a lot, but you were more scared of him then. Now you're...
She paused.
Sad.
Oh.
All of a sudden, his eyes itched.
I guess I am.
Are you still mad at him?
Before he could answer, she turned her brimming eyes to his...
Because the last time my daddy went to Iraq, I was mad, and he came home in a box. I was pissed at Grandpa Jack, and then he died. The last morning I saw Tom and Alex, I'd gotten mad at them, too, the night before. We made up, but...
A tear dribbled down one cheek.
You didn't make any of that happen,
he said, part of him wishing that if evil thoughts could kill, his father would have keeled over 5 years before the night of the hammer. On the other hand, he couldn't have wished that hard, because he'd also lied for the bastard when the chips were down.
Were you angry at Eli?
When she shook her head, he said,
See? But I'm afraid.
Her lower lip shuddered.
I'm still mad at you. I understand why, but don't lie to me again, Chris. It hurts too much, and I don't want you to die, too.
The right thing to do would be to give her a hug or touch her. But he didn't want to make a mistake. I'm not going to die, he said, though he probably shouldn't make promises he mightn't keep. I only want to try and do what's right. I'm not into this to get myself killed.
Well, that's a relief, Jaden said, stomping from the woods. He looked as Ellie stifled a watery laugh. What? What'd I say? But his mouth was turned in a grin. Oh, he said, reeling the little girl in for a knuckle rub. You thought I meant that. No, Ellie squealed, cracking up all over again. It is, however, an excellent question. Jaden gave Ellie's head a final tousle. Lena or no Lena, what is the game plan once we get to Rule? People there you can trust?
A few.
Crouching over a sparse patch of unbroken snow, he made an X.
If Rule's at the center of a clock, we're coming in from up here.
He poked a finger at 10 o'clock.
We have two choices. Either loop clockwise to the hospice here.
He traced an arc to 2 o'clock.
Or keep on this route and drop down to the southwest corner here.
An X at 7 o'clock.
Which is faster?
Ellie asked.
6 of 1, 6 dozen of the other. We can trust Kincaid, the doctor, I think, and some girls I know who lived with Alex, Sarah and Tori. Greg and Prue from my squad are good guys, but they're all the way on the other side of town.
He pointed to 4 o'clock.
The only catch is Jess's house, where Alex was. It's not that far from the zone.
Where the people-eaters are.
When Chris nodded, Ellie continued,
Can't we go straight down and still end up where Alex lived?
Well, there are more houses and people, but yeah, if we're careful.
Sounds like those girls are the first stop, then. Jaden went to his horse, pulled open a saddlebag, and withdrew a camp pot and 3 enameled mugs, as well as a Ziploc of tea and another of fish jerky. What then?
I don't know. I've been gone 2 months. Chris said as Jaden carefully scooped handfuls of untrammeled snow into the pot. It's the middle of March now. A lot could have happened.
Given his many dreams, he was willing to bet on it.
Okay.
Nesting the pot over flames, Jaden doled out cups.
So, we go to Sarah and Tori and what? You make like Moses, let my people go? Or are we just going to bust everyone out?
I honestly haven't thought that far. Guess it depends on if I end up in the prison house.
We won't let that happen,
Ellie said promptly. Jaden only filled a tea ball with loose leaves.
How likely is that?
I'd be lying if I said it wasn't a real strong possibility. What I'm hoping is that the council will listen. I can't believe that they'll just shoot me, he lied.
They won't,
Ellie said, fishing out a piece of jerky.
Oh?
Jaden raised both eyebrows.
And you know this because...
Because, she said, gnawing jerky that was the color of an old loafer, they'd have to shoot through me first. He and Jaden looked at each other, and then Chris said,
Come again?
I saved your life, Chris, so I'm responsible for you from now on.
I think it goes the other way around, Jaden said. He owes you.
Yeah, but then he saved me from the lake.
So we're even, Chris said. I'm not letting you do anything dumb, Ellie.
Too late. I'm here, she said. Seriously, guys, you think they'll shoot a cute kid and her little dog Toto, too?
Chris started, then shut his mouth.
He and Jaden traded another long look, and then they both began to laugh.
See? Ellie said, looking very pleased. She offered Chris the bag. Jerky?
Chapter 98 Between Jed's maps and a thumbnail of the village's layout, zone, patrols, and approach routes Weller once drew, Tom would have found what he was looking for easily enough. As with the lake, however, the crows pointed the way, sketching lazy pinwheels above the woods southwest of Rule. Now that they were into March and the daytime temps were inching past freezing most days, the faintly gassy smell helped too. So did his horse, who finally balked a half-mile shy and refused to budge. That was all right. On foot, he had a better chance of slipping in unnoticed. So he offloaded his gear, then unharnessed and gave the horse a healthy slap to send it on its way.
If you didn't know better, Tom thought you could almost imagine that you'd dropped into some horror story where the village appeases the local gods by sending out the occasional sacrifice. He knew better. Rule's story was written in the haphazard scatter of browning bones scored by teeth and knives, the remnants of clothes and discarded backpacks, a hoary scraggle of wig so picked over there was nothing left but ripped lace and a few strands of too red hair. What almost troubled him more, however, was a wrecked pyramid of decaying human heads that lay at the end of a kind of processional way. This was marked by the skeletonized remains of animals heaped on thinning snow beneath gently swaying rib cages still dangling from Paraline. From the shapes of the skulls and teeth, he thought these had been wolves. The whole setup was ritualistic, with a weird Blair Witch vibe. He wondered if this spot had been claimed by the wolf tribe, those Chuckies Cindy saw with Alex. If true, then Tom was now standing close to or in the same spot Alex once had. He didn't know if that was an omen, good or bad.
Either way, no Chuckies have been here for a while.
Tom studied the crows hopscotching over that jumble of human skulls and disarticulated lower jaws. Only the barest remnants of leathery skin and desiccated muscle dangled from bone. Something had happened at that pyramid, too. The skulls hadn't simply fallen to the snow, but been knocked off, some by several feet. One lay far to the right. From its position, he could almost imagine that someone had tried lobbing the skull like a stone. Nearby were two shredded, blood-stained bits of cloth, part of a parka and a flannel shirt, torn off in a fight, maybe. But the edges weren't as frayed as he would have expected from a rip, probably one honking sharp knife. But where was the flood of Chuckies that was supposed to have borne down on Rule? In the last 4 days, Tom had seen only a few and at a distance, and twice during the mid-afternoon, which was also very bad news. Tom held his breath and listened. So still. This close, he ought to hear something. The thock of an axe, the distant clatter of wagons or horses, perhaps even the occasional voice. In the dead silence of the Hindu Kush, he'd once patrolled a mountainside and caught snatches of evening prayers 10,000 feet above a Pashtun village he never saw. But here, nothing. Where is everyone? He was certain he wasn't too late. With all those men and their wagons, the horses, and now the kids, he had to have beaten Melly and that old commander in black, probably by no more than half a day, but even a few hours was better than nothing. Something really wrong here. A slight movement to his right, and his gaze dropped in time to see a small field mouse squirm from an empty socket of that lone skull. The animal froze, only its whiskers trembling, before it wheeled and scurried away. Something rotten in Denmark, Yorick. Time to find out what. Time, Tom hoped, to save his kids. It must have been an old mercury switch from a defunct thermostat connected to a battery. Moved the garbage, disturbed the switch, the lead spark, and boom, an easy bomb. One second he was shouting for Weller and dashing toward the church, the next he was very cold and crumpled on his side. A lucky thing, because there was old copper in his mouth, more blood drying under his nose and along his neck. If he'd been on his back, he might have choked to death on his own blood. His chest felt like someone had dropped a boulder on him. His ears hurt, and they whooshed, a good indicator that he still had eardrums to hear with. At first, he thought the sound was only from the blast wave, but when he rolled onto his back, gasping at jags of pain, he saw clots of black smoke chuffing over blue sky and realized that what he heard was the muted chugs of a fire that had yet to burn itself out. Sitting up was an exercise in slow torture. Everything hurt. He wasn't coughing up any more of the red stuff, so his lungs might be okay. A blast could kill you a lot of different ways. Some, being vaporized or skewered by shrapnel or bleeding out because your leg was gone, were a lot faster than others. Have the bad luck of being too close to a blast wave, and the hollow organs, lungs, heart, guts, could burst, sometimes fast, sometimes slow. When he was finally up, he propped himself on his elbows, concentrated on moving air in and out of his aching lungs, studied what was left of the church, and realized just how lucky he'd been. The church looked like something out of a travel brochure advertising tours of castle ruins. The tower had ruptured in a halo of stone and splintered wood. Mangled brass bells and sprays of shattered stained glass glittered on the snow. The blast had been powerful enough to fling the smallest bells toward the forest edging what had been the church's parking lot. The crowns of several nearby trees, principally heavier evergreens, had snapped, while other, thinner hardwoods were bowled over by the blast wind. Three walls still stood, but the rest of the church was a gutted shell, surrounded by blasted pews and the fluttering remnants of tattered hymnals. He ought to be dead. They'd tethered the animals about an eighth of a mile away. He thought he'd covered half the distance back before he'd dropped the reins and sprinted for the church. So, tack on another 50 yards before the explosion? Either way, give or take, he was still too darned close. The fact that he'd been blown back so far, knocked unconscious, and bled from his nose and ears proved that. If the explosion had happened, say, in a town or a narrow alley, the blast overpressure would have ruptured his heart and blown his lungs apart. What saved his ass was that the church stood alone, with no nearby structures or even trees to capture and amplify the blast wave. He was alive because of dumb luck, and that was all. By some miracle, he still had his weapons. The Uzi on its retention strap, Jed's Bravo snugged in that back scabbard, and the Glock, Alex's Glock as he thought of it, in its cross-draw. He had extra ammo stashed in his overvest, too, also lucky because the horses had scattered. From their tracks, he knew at least one had not headed back to camp. That, he hoped, would be his ride, but hunting it down now would be a mistake. Instead, he kicked snow to hide his blood, then shucked his vest and used that to scour away the Tom-sized divot where he'd lain and the stumbling tracks he made as he headed into the trees. They came a few hours later. By then, he'd moved downwind and well into the woods, hauling himself by painful degrees high into the deep recesses of a thick, sturdy cedar. There were three, and he recognized them all. Melly's square, compact frame was easy. With his white hair cut high and tight and that black uniform, the way he carried himself, Tom thought the old guy was used to command. "But my God, I know you." His mind flashed to his battle with that blood-eyed girl on the snow. "You're one of the guys I saw watching from the woods." The third person was a kid, a boy in overwhites. The boy's head was up, sampling the air, looking for him. Tom was too far away to see the boy's eyes, but he knew they were the same maddened red of that Chucky he'd fought to the death. Given the guy in black, Tom thought this must be the same boy he'd spotted in the trees 2 weeks ago. But now this kid was riding a horse, and he's working with people. Tom's skin dewed with fresh sweat. How is this possible? He watched as the three made a slow perambulation around the church in an ever-widening spiral, looking for tracks, trying to figure out if anyone got away. The oldsters bent their heads to the snow, but the kid kept his head up like a bloodhound. The Uzi was silenced, chambered, and ready to go, and now he inched a finger over the selector switch. Kill them now? No way anyone will hear the shots. But he wasn't a sniper, and he might miss. Worse, he was only one person, and he was willing to bet the old commander had a fair number of men. Try to rescue the kids on his own, he'd probably end up dead. Wait for a better time. Think of a plan. Heart pounding, he watched as they continued their search pattern until the debris field petered out. Melly and the commander conferred about something. The Chucky only scanned, turning his horse in a slow 360, and then they left, returning to camp the way they'd come. For the rest of that day and through the night, Tom stayed put, using his retention straps to anchor himself in case he dozed. The orange of the fire eventually diminished. What light there was splashed gray and dim from the waxing moon. The hissing in his ears diminished enough that he heard the flames' dying crackles, and at some point a jangle of hardware. That made his pulse ratchet up a notch, until he reconsidered that a solitary rider at night made no sense. Probably his horse, or Weller's. He thought about it for a few seconds, then decided he was much better off with a ride than without one. So he called to it as softly as he could, coaxing the animal into the woods, wincing at every crackle and snap of brush and brambles. In the moonlight, he saw the horse slip close to the tree in which he hid and then stop. That was the only good in an otherwise very long and terrible night. He still ached, his gimpy right leg complained, and now he was both hungry and thirsty. Scooping snow from nearby limbs, he let it melt down his throat to take the edge off. He even managed a fitful doze. Mostly, he worried about the kids and his next move. The one thing he didn't believe Melly would do was kill the children outright. It just didn't fit. True, that commander had Chuckies. They would need food. But why waste kids? More than enough oldsters around to keep the Chuckies happy for a while. What he kept coming back to was that boy. The old commander was messing around with Chuckies. But how? And why does he need my kids? There had to be a reason why Melly had gathered children for her buddy in black. Tom suspected she and the commander wanted the rule children for the same reason, whatever that was. Except for two dead dogs, a bigger blood splotch that looked as if it might have been a person, and a riderless horse nervously wandering around the horse barn, the farmstead was deserted. The horse trough had been moved, and the stockpile of explosives gear was gone. That he'd counted on. First principles. All warfare is based on deception. Every tent had been broken down and taken away, except his, set apart, close to the trees. He stared for a very long time, first from across the corral and on his horse, and then on foot as he worked a careful perimeter, thinking, "Fool me once." He bet Finn read Sun Tzu, too. It took him a while. The snow was all broken up, deeply incised with horse hooves, boots, and this was a surprise, the cut of at least 7 or 8 wagons. But he finally spotted what did not belong. A thin curl of debt cord coiled around a corner guy and grommet of his tent. Following that took him to a trip release hooked to the front zipper. Peering through a seam, he saw a half-block of plastique with a Vietnam-era M28 detonator stuck in one end, molded to the tent's center pole. The trip release meant that he'd use more force on the zipper. One quick tug would arm the fuse, and then boom. Not good. He cut the cord with his K-bar, then broke down the rest of the bomb. Either they think one or both of us got out, or they're being cautious. Each scenario was bad news, and meant he would have to be doubly careful when he searched the rest of the farmstead. None of the barns were booby-trapped. He took his time with the equipment shed, studying the roof and where the walls met concrete and then snow. Nothing. Now that he had his gear and binos, he peered in through the one window. Bare sawhorses, empty shelves. Using paracord, he carefully tied one end to the doorknob and strung it out behind. Then he wound the other end around the saddle horn, boosted himself onto the saddle, and spurred the horse into a sudden gallop. Startled, the horse bolted, and the door caromed off its hinges, but nothing blew up. Save for a single half roll of magnesium tape and a bottle of aluminum powder that had rolled under a sawhorse, the equipment shed was a metal and concrete shell. Pocketing the magnesium and ground aluminum, he walked out to the cistern. The cap was still in place, but once bitten, twice shy. When he was satisfied it wasn't rigged, he shoved the heavy concrete to one side and peered in. His breath huffed out in relief. Still attached to an iron bolt on the cap's underbelly, the black paracord was taut, exactly as he'd left it. Reaching in, he hauled up the heavy pack in which he'd stowed the lion's share of his bomb-making materials, under Melly's nose the whole time. Clearing a house of potential booby traps takes time. All the rooms were clear and empty, except Weller's. Interesting. Both hands on his Uzi, Tom turned a slow look. With its tight hospital corners, Weller's rack could have passed any drill instructor's muster. From his few changes of clothing in a duffel to his cracked leather dop kit, everything was squared and ordered.
Why not empty the room or booby-trap it?
Two reasons. Either the contents held no value, or, on the off chance Weller survived, they're telling him to kiss off. Every soldier carries keepsakes and charms, usually on them or in their overvests, letters, pictures, Bibles, rosaries, scapulars. His own, a St. George medal from his grandmother and a picture of his little sisters, were tucked in the same sock drawer with his dog tags back home and so much dust. The tags he wore now were Jed's. As far as he knew, Weller had no tags, but he was an old soldier, and habits die hard. They were in the dop kit, the first place Tom looked, and protected by a Ziploc baggie, a newspaper clipping, and an old Polaroid. The clipping, almost 3 years old, read, "Houghton victim remembered as determined and good friend." Friends of Amanda L. Pedersen recalled a vivacious, generous, and hard-working young woman ready to offer a helping hand and determined to return to school and pursue a college degree. Totally devastated was how Claire Mason characterized her reaction to the news of Pedersen's disappearance after a freak boating accident in Lake Superior. I can't even imagine what she was doing out there with a bunch of college kids in the first place. She couldn't swim, and can you imagine her poor parents, how they'll never have a body? It's just terrible. The boat on which Pedersen was a passenger went down in the still frigid waters of Superior after a fire broke out in the vessel's engine room. Repeated efforts by fellow passengers to free Pedersen, trapped below deck, failed, and the vessel sank before a Coast Guard helicopter arrived on scene. Recovery efforts were suspended due to poor visibility and the depth of the lake, which has been recorded at over 500 feet in that area. No further searches for the missing boat or Houghton resident are planned. Amanda was just the nicest girl, Jack LaParma, a close friend, said. She'd had some hard times, but she was completely determined, ready to move on. Pedersen is reported to have enjoyed snowmobiling as well as time spent with family and friends. The names of Pedersen's fellow passengers, as well as the boat's owner, are currently being withheld until a preliminary investigation is completed and a cause of the engine fire can be established. Given the loss of the boat, however, and the reported lack of eyewitness accounts, a source close to the current investigation suggested that the death will be classified as accidental. No criminal charges are currently pending or anticipated. Pedersen is survived by her parents, Claire and Benjamin, a brother, Theodore, and grandparents, Ron and Esther Pedersen of Houghton, and William and Rosemary Weller of Marinisco. The picture accompanying the article showed Weller's granddaughter in jeans and a tee, sitting atop a picnic table. In the background was a river, boats, and a lift bridge. The Polaroid was so aged most of the color had bled. The ghostly image of two men posed before a Quonset. Each held an M16. Both wore camo battle dress, but only Weller, just as grizzled then as now, sported three tabs on his left sleeve, Special Forces, Rangers, and Airborne, and a smoke tucked behind one ear. The man Tom zeroed in on stood to Weller's right, grim and blocky, with a barrel chest and thighs like tree trunks. His skull was so large, his dark hair, cut high and tight, looked like the bristles of a broom. On the back, in faded ballpoint, Finn 68, Ben Trey. The name of the town or village meant nothing to Tom. He squinted at Finn's uniform, trying to make out his rank. Major or lieutenant colonel. And was that a Medical Corps insignia? He thought it might be. Weller's three chevrons put his rank as a sergeant. A commander and his sarge. Now Tom had two names, Chris Prentice and Finn. Which monster to take on first? That was the question. Weller had marked the two most likely spots where Rule might post archers, but Tom spotted none, and no arrows came whizzing from the trees. While he was happy not to end up with an arrow through his neck or his back, Tom began to suspect that something was seriously wrong. By the third block in from the woods, he was positive. The doors of every house stood open. From the splintered jambs and screens hanging at cockeyed angles, these were forced entries. Each home had been stormed, searched, and then, his eyes drifted to a drippy red spray-painted X right of a jam, ticked off the to-do list. Raids for food and other supplies would be his first guess. But what if they were looking for Chucky's? If Rule's children and grandchildren and all their friends had returned, going door to door to hunt them down made sense. The timing was about right. Judging from blown snow in front halls, whatever happened was a couple weeks back. But you wouldn't stop there, would you? There was no timetable, no way of knowing when more kids might show up. You'd mount patrols and guards. So where was everyone? He turned a slow, careful circle. Long icicles fanged eaves and gutters on those homes with southern and western exposures. Most of the houses facing north were mantled with thick snow. Anyone still around would need to stay warm. He sniffed and got a light scent of wood smoke drifting down from the northeast and at the center of town. He still didn't hear anything other than a faint sough of a light breeze, but people would be conserving energy, not moving around much. Something orange and large suddenly slunk around the corner of a two-story to his left. Startled, he spun Uzi up before he realized what he was looking at. The instant the cat spotted Tom, it froze, one paw poised above the snow. Something furry dangled from its jaws. They regarded one another for a beat. He couldn't speak for the cat, but his heart was hammering. Evidently unimpressed, the cat trotted up snowy steps, then eeled through an open front door. Tom lowered his weapon. A cat? This made no sense. You break down doors, you look for supplies. In a starvation situation, pets were fair game. Dogs he could see sparing. They sensed Chucky's. You needed horses, too. But no one really needed. If he hadn't been staring after the cat, he never would have seen them. As it was, what his eye snagged on was a distant olive-green blur, a parka, and a quick spark of sun in the far woods to the left behind the house. Theoretically, you could get into Rule any number of ways. Those two boys angling through the trees must have dropped down from the north. Both had rifles and were moving slowly, cautiously, their heads tilted to the snow. They hadn't spotted him yet, but they would. Darting up the steps, he bolted into the house after the cat. As soon as he was inside, he noticed two things at the same time. A long, dried bloodstain on the floor and the stink of decay. That cat had a nice stash of rotting mice somewhere. Trotting past a narrow understairs closet to his left, he moved into the kitchen, which was a shambles. Cupboards stood open, drawers had been pulled and dumped, the pantry door was open by a hair. Several floorboards had been pried up, too, both in the pantry and out here, leaving dark rectangular slots wide enough for a person to drop through. The aroma of decay was stronger here, as was the smell of cold dirt from the crawl space under the house. The cat was nowhere in sight. Sidestepping a gap, he peered over a windowsill above the sink. The two boys were just clearing a woodpile alongside a detached garage. Both simultaneously looked over their shoulders at something further back. One boy, smaller, a mop of brown hair, made a warding-off gesture, waving someone back. Bad news, if there's more than just these two. Craning, he took his eyes away a split second to see if he could make out who else was there and how many. It was a split second too long. When he jumped his gaze back, the other boy, older, taller, dark-haired, was looking right at him.
"Shit!" he hissed. He ducked away, already knowing it was too late, but he still might be able to avoid a fight. Pivoting, he started out of the kitchen, intending to head for the second story, because it was always easier to defend high, and he might be able to make his way out a window. Something flickered to his left, and he saw a boy dashing around to the front, and the second, taller boy down low, wheeling around the kitchen side steps. No time for the stairs. Dropping to a sit, Tom threw his legs over the edge of the gap in the kitchen floor, then slid all the way through. No more than 2 feet high, the crawl space was virtually pitch black, except for thin stringers of light dashing through chinks in the floor. The air reeked of mildew and the eye-watering stench of dead mice. Tongue cringing from the clog of decay, he took small sips through his teeth as he slithered on his belly over cold earth and deeper into the crawl space. The smell of rot, and now a septic system desperately in need of emptying. The people who'd lived here must have kept on crapping until their toilets overflowed. Far enough. Turning onto his side, he faced the way he'd come. Light glimmered through the gap. If they looked, they wouldn't see him so long as he remained still. Then he remembered the Chuckies saw very well in the dark. Either way, if it came down to a fight, he thought he had a chance. Even with Jed's Bravo in its scabbard, there was a foot of clearance between his Uzi and the underbelly of the house, plenty of room to roll. Take out anything that comes through the gap.
He tucked the silenced Uzi to his chest, business end trained on that wedge of silver light. After that, he would have to be fast. The remaining kid could shoot down, but both boys were carrying bolt actions. He fingered the Uzi's selector to full auto.
Shoot up, really spray it, and then...
Directly over his head, the floorboards creaked. A soft scree. More steps. The gauzy light rippling as the boy moved across the kitchen. He heard more thumps as the second boy came down the front hall. Cringing back, Tom tried making himself as small as possible. And felt a hand on his shoulder. Chapter 99.
A scream surged up Tom's throat, crashed over his tongue, then flattened against the wall of his teeth. Tucking, he rolled away once, twice, then brought the silenced Uzi to bear. Just before it was too late, in the split second before his finger tightened on the trigger and sprayed gunfire he could not take back, he saw what he'd missed before, because his eyes hadn't adjusted and he'd been focused on the gap, not what waited at his back in the dark. The Chucky, who'd decided on the crawl space as his personal meat locker, had been a busy, busy boy. In the gray gloaming, Tom thought there might be as many as 4 bodies, but certainly 2 because of the heads. Pro forma, for an accurate count at any bomb scene, forget heads. Heads pop like corks from champagne, count left feet. The soft, fleshy parts, eyes, noses, lips, tongues, were gone. The heads stared with wide, black-eyed wonder. One body was being systematically consumed from the waist up, the Chucky probably reaching in and scooping out all the good stuff before setting to work on the leaner rib meat. Alongside a half-gnawed thigh was a spool of colon in a neat cobra's coil. Jesus! Fear spidered down his neck.
Either those boys were living here or had dropped by to grab a quick snack, and here I've saved them the trouble of hunting me down. But they hadn't figured out where he was yet. Sweat oozing over his temples, he rolled away from the grisly sight and readied the Uzi. He could still take them. If these Chuckies weren't the only ones, or they lived nearby, he would have to make tracks pretty fast. Maybe this was why the village had pulled back, because there were too many Chuckies and no way to defend against them all. But then I should have spotted more, not just these two. Then he heard one of the boys.
"Did you hear that?"
Jaden whispered. From his place in the middle of the kitchen, Chris gave Jaden a slow nod, then put a finger to his lips. The sound had been brief, a kind of scurry like a rat or opossum.
Or a raccoon.
He tipped a look at the hole in the floor. From the smell, it seemed as if something had taken up residence. Maybe the cat, whose prints he'd spotted in bag. His gaze inched from the hole to the hall beyond Jaden. In the weak light, he saw watery tread marks, too late to ask Jaden if there'd been water before. They'd stopped at Jess's first. The house was empty, the girls' bedrooms cleaned out, yet the floors in Jess's house were intact. This was not the case with two other houses on the same block that he knew had been occupied the last time he was in Rule. The only difference between those houses and Jess's was that Jess had a root cellar and basement. Every house without one or the other showed similar damage. Floorboards pried up or simply splintered with sledges and axes. Open drawers, crap on the floor, broken dishes, the backs of cupboards staved in with hammers. Now he swept his eyes over the wreckage that had been the Landry's kitchen. He thought he understood what had happened here. Whoever was left in Rule had gone around ripping up houses on footings to look in crawl spaces and behind walls for supplies that had been squirreled away. Then each house had been X'd from the list,
which means they're pretty desperate.
His gaze lingered on the pantry door, open just a crack. Things certainly had gone downhill here in a faint scurry, and then a shuffle from directly overhead. At the sound, his eyes darted to the ceiling. He knew it. That ghostly flash of a face hadn't been his imagination. Now he was very glad he'd made Ellie wait behind the woodpile with Mina when the dog started getting antsy. Looking up at Jaden, he aimed a finger at the ceiling, then lifted his chin in the direction of the front hall. Nodding, Jaden turned a quiet about face, hugged the left wall, and padded for the front door, with Chris only steps behind. Pausing at the bottom of the staircase, Jaden leaned in for a quick peek, then darted across to take up position in a doorway that led to a formal dining room. Moving past the understairs closet, Chris paused at the newel post, tapped his chest with a forefinger, then turned to aim at the stairs. He had a brief moment when he wondered just why he was bothering to clear this house, then considered that something had gotten under the dog's skin and that the only good changed was a dead one.
"Unless it's Lena," a small inner voice whispered. "This is what you wanted, right? For her to follow? So what if she got here first?" "No way," he thought right back. "Lena knows Jess, not the Landrys. She had no reason to be in this house." "Unless she's running an end around," the voice said. "You drop north, so she circles, tracks you by scent, and meets you head on." "Yes, but accomplishing what?" He was overthinking this. Lena hadn't shown herself at all in the last 4 days. He wondered now if she'd followed. Maybe he and Jaden weren't enough of a draw. "Can't worry about Lena now." He just hoped that whatever was up there wasn't armed. Socking his rifle against his shoulder, he followed his weapon in a slow creep up the stairs, keeping to the right, away from any squeaky centers. The hall above opened right and left, and he jumped his eyes to the right corner and then the left, bringing his rifle around, clearing each slice of the pie. To his relief, he had wall to his back the whole way. "Make it to the corner, clear left, then pivot, move to the right, clear that corner, then get the hell out of the stairway." What they did next depended on how many doors were open. Something vaulted from a side table snugged against the far wall. Jerking right, he brought his rifle around, but he was off balance. The cat barreled into his chest, dug in with its claws, spat, and then launched itself, using him as a springboard to catapult itself the rest of the way down the steps. With a yelp, he jerked off a wild shot, then staggered as his heel snagged. He fell backward, his head cracking a step hard enough to bring on a shower of shooting stars, and then he was watching his boots whip past as he turned a somersault and caromed down the steps. "Are you okay?" Jaden's face, chalky with alarm, swam into view. "You could have broken your neck. Cat scared the hell out of me." "Ugh," Chris croaked. He could only lie a moment, listening to the ball of his battered head. His right shoulder hurt where he'd collided with hardwood, but he thought it could have been worse. Propping himself up on his elbows, he gulped back against a swirl of vertigo, then made a face, worked his jaws, and spat out a gob of red foam. "Bit myself. Stupid cat!"
Just be glad that's all it was. Propping his own gun against the wall, Jaden helped him to his feet. Can we get out of here? This place gives me the creeps, and it stinks. That cat's probably dragged in all sorts of crap. It's probably crapping all over the place. Sure. Shaking his head clear, he looked around and found his rifle, which had jumped from his hands, to slide a few feet from the understairs closet. With a groan, he bent.
We should, anyway,
he said, flicking the safety.
Even though we're inside, someone might have heard the shot and come to check.
At his back, the door to the understairs closet slammed open with a loud bang, and then Jaden was screaming, Chris! Look out! Look out! Look! Chapter 100
This is dumb,
Ellie muttered darkly, one hand hooked under Mina's collar and the other clutching her savage. Huddled by her side, Mina only shuffled but didn't break her stance. Any sound she might have made, and she wouldn't, no matter what Chris said, because Mina was trained to be quiet, was stifled by the loop of a leash cinched down around her snout. Ellie crept forward, aimed a peek around the corner of the woodpile 3 yards over, but saw only the garage nestled in the woods and the far corner of the house into which Jaden and Chris had gone what seemed hours ago. Pulling back, she gnawed her lower lip, tried to think of what to do, how long to wait. She could feel the dog vibrating under her hand. Mina wanted to go, get in the fight, if there was one. Ellie still wasn't sure. Oh, she wasn't stupid. That gunshot had been very muffled, a tiny pop at this distance, but distinct enough that she understood what it was. Yet there was only the one, no return fire at all, no shouts or screams either, which, even with miles between her and the house, she'd probably hear because it was so creepy quiet. Anyway, it wasn't as if she would go running to see what happened. Only little kids did that. But she should do something, because right now she figured one of two things was happening. Either Chris or Jaden was picking himself off the floor because one of them had tripped, or they'd both been jumped and were now being torn up by a swarm of people-eaters, in which case what were she and Mina doing sitting on their butts? She snicked the safety of her savage on, off, on, off, on, off, made a decision.
I'm going to count to 10, she said to Mina. Then we're going.
Which route to take? She ought to stay under cover, out of sight. Scooching forward, she gave Mina a little tug to move her out of the way, then hitched around for a better view of that yard way out there. Honestly, she needed binoculars. Her eyes roamed over gray trees and clean white snow blushing here and there with shafts of the setting sun. Settled on the garage, set well back in the woods. A straight shot from here. And then she could... A twinkle of light. A second later, the garage door cracked open. A hand appeared, and then an arm, followed by the hump of a shoulder, and Ellie watched as the girl, a spidery, slinky thing, emerged with a big honking knife.
Oh, Ellie's heart jumped a jig. She crowded herself and Mina back fast. Don't see me, don't see me.
In the brief glimpse she'd had of the girl, and oh boy, she was a people-eater, all right. Ellie registered only long hair clotted with dirt, and something wrong with the girl's face, like another people-eater had taken a big chunk. Ellie wasn't sure. She waited, her heart boing-a-boing-a-boinging in her chest, ears alert for the shush of snow or crack of a branch. Nothing came, and Mina didn't budge.
Okay. So the people-eater doesn't know I'm here.
Lucked out. But now Ellie really had to do something. Maybe that shot she'd heard was a signal. Come and get it, we got juicy boys. Easing just far enough to clear the woodpile, Ellie saw the girl low to the ground, scuttling like a tarantula. Blocky and square, that knife looked more like a cleaver. Ellie's hand squeezed her rifle, but who was she kidding? If she sent Mina after the people-eater, her dog might get chopped. Fire off a warning shot, though. That might help Jaden and Chris, but that people-eater would find her pretty quick, too.
But I have to do something.
From deep in the house came a wild but very muffled shout, a sound swaddled in cotton, and then a soft bam, something breaking or a door slamming. At the same moment, the girl reached the corner, wormed her way beneath a long, whippy piece of metal where the house met the ground, and went under the house. That did it. There was something inside with Chris and Jaden, something very bad, and now this equally awful people-eater was coming at them from behind. "Go, Mina!" Jumping to her feet, Ellie whipped the leash off Mina's muzzle. The dog took off like a rocket, and Ellie was right behind, screaming, "Go, Mina! Go, Mina! Go, go, go!"
Chapter 101.
Chris only had time to register Jaden's shout and the crash of the door. In the next second, something launched itself into his back, spinning him completely around. He got a brief glimpse of the kitchen before the changed girl or boy he didn't know bowled him over, slamming him face first to the floor. His forehead connected with wood, and he felt the tender skin, which was only just knitting up from the fight with that changed in Hannah's kitchen, tear as he bounced. Face roaring with pain, blinking away a sudden wash of warm blood, he got one knee under him and tried bucking the changed from his back. Behind him, near the stairs, Jaden was still screaming, and then he heard dimly what sounded like heavy boots clumping down steps. Another yelp from Jaden, this time one of panic, quickly choked off, and Chris realized that there had been something besides a cat upstairs after all. Chris heard a whickering over his head, felt something slip around his neck. An instant later, he had no air. Dropping his useless rifle, he clawed, trying to work his fingers under the rope as the changed put a knee in the middle of his back and pushed at the same time that it pulled. Chris felt his nails score his skin. His pulse thundered. Black spiders scurried over his vision. His chest felt as if someone had dropped a huge weight, caving in ribs, smashing his lungs. He reached back to swat at his attacker with both hands, but managed only increasingly feeble slaps. He felt the changed grope, then fist his hair, crank his head to expose his neck as the rope crushed his throat. Chris was losing control of his body now, beginning to jitter. The pain in his chest was ferocious, a hard boil that would blow him apart. Everything was going black, inside and out. He couldn't fight anymore. His legs were juddering uncontrollably now, and so were his hands. He only just registered the slap of wood, the drum of his boots. All at once, his strength evaporated. He felt himself go limp. The rope saw through the tender flesh of his neck. What should have been a surge of bright pain was only the tiniest blister of a faraway firecracker sputtering fast. His mind slipped, his hold on consciousness sluing as it had when Hannah's poison streamed through his veins. An insidious blackness oozed over his vision as the edges of his world collapsed. Just before he lost his sight completely, he saw something, someone, suddenly rear, seeming to emerge from the guts of the earth. A voice, very distant, as wispy as smoke, "Over here!" But then that was it. All at once, Chris was falling, all thought disintegrating, and where there should have been a floor or the ground or the earth to hold him, there was nothing except Jess pulling together in a swarm of shadows. He thought she might be saying something, but he was moving so fast he shot past and never...
Chapter 102.
Rolling, Tom surged through the gap. The nearest Chucky, a beefy kid in stained jeans and a too large camo jacket, had a knee in the dark-eyed boy's back and a rope in one hand. Tom could tell the dark-eyed boy was nearly gone. The kid's body quivered, his face was black, and his eyes rolled to show the whites going crimson with hemorrhage. Behind them, Tom glimpsed the smaller boy thrashing and kicking at another Chucky, a very large girl raining punches. "Over here!" he shouted. Flinching, the beefy Chucky relaxed his hold on the boy, who collapsed in a heap and didn't move. Tom fired a quick three-shot burst, a soft pfft. The Chucky's chest ruptured in a crimson starburst, and he was falling back, even as Tom was clambering out of the crawl space and advancing, moving fast. The girl was still wailing away on the smaller boy, but now seemed to realize the danger, and she was rearing back, beginning to turn. "Stay down!" Tom roared at the smaller boy. The girl flung herself to one side as Tom squeezed off another burst, stitching shots in the front and storm doors. Jags of glass splashed to the floor, and then the smaller boy was singing, "Gun! Gun! She's got my gun!" Tom saw it at the same moment as the girl pivoted, heard the bolt being thrown as the barrel of a long gun swung around. Dropping to one knee, he ducked under her line of fire and aimed up. One second, the girl's head was there, and the next... The second boy was panting, trying to roll, get to his feet. Blood streaked his face. Tom couldn't tell if it was all his, but at least this kid was breathing. "Who are—" Tom didn't reply. Turning, he raced back to the dark-eyed boy. The kid, 17, 18, he thought, was still down, not moving at all, sightless eyes staring, tongue purple and bulging, blood on his throat, that rope cinched tight. "God, no!" Tom dropped to his knees, stripped away the rope, then drew a hissing breath through his teeth at how deeply the kid's neck was cut. "No!" It was the smaller kid, his voice breaking. He knelt by the body. "No, no! He can't be dead! He can't—" "Quiet!" Turning his head, Tom listened for a breath. Nothing. No whisper of air against his cheek. "Kid, come on!" Closing his eyes, he put his head on the boy's chest. Silence. "Don't do this, kid. Don't—" Beyond Tom from the kitchen came the enormous bang of a door smashing drywall. Startled, still on his knees, he jerked up, hurtling out of the pantry, swarming up from the gap in the floor through which he'd slithered only moments before, was a girl, a silent, deadly horror with a monstrous rip in one cheek through which he could see teeth and pink gums and tongue. In her hand was the largest, sharpest corn knife Tom had ever seen. "Get back!" Sweeping the smaller boy aside with his right hand, Tom lunged for his Uzi with his left. She was so fast, all he had time for was a one-handed snatch, his left fist closing around the barrel of his Uzi, and then he was swinging up, aiming for her knife hand. She saw it coming and dropped in a lunge like a fencer coming in under a blade as the Uzi whizzed past. Pulled off balance by his own momentum, Tom caught the glint, heard the corn knife whistling in a fast, sidelong chop for his exposed left flank, and thought that might just be the last mistake he ever made. A brown blur rocketed into the girl from behind. There was a clash of teeth, and then the Chucky was screeching, surging to her feet as the dog clamped down on her left arm and dug in. Spinning free, the corn knife whirred past Tom's chest, missing by a fraction of an inch to bury itself in the opposite wall. Out of the corner of his left eye, he saw the smaller boy scrambling for his rifle. Not 3 feet away, the Chucky whirled like a dervish, and the dog, jaws snapped tight, sailed round and round like a shot put. And when he saw the dog, Tom thought, "Wait!" To his right, the kitchen door suddenly crashed wide open. Flipping the Uzi to the ready, Tom jammed the stock into his shoulder and whipped his weapon around just as a corn tassel blonde, much too young to be a Chucky, Tom still had the presence of mind to see that, bolted through the door. "Mina!" the girl screamed, socking a savage to her shoulder. "Release!" At that, Tom felt his heart burst with a shock of disbelief and a swift, sweet, stunning joy. For him, and only for a split second, the world simply stopped, fell away, and there was nothing he wanted more than to sweep her up, hold her close. But then he was breaking his stance, pivoting back for the Chucky, trigger finger taking up the slack. "Shoot her!" the brown-haired boy screamed as he charged to Tom's side. "Shoot her, Ellie! Shoot her!" They all fired together, his Uzi still quiet, but the boy's rifle roaring and even the savage making a very large noise for such a puny gun. Then, still on his knees, because all of a sudden he couldn't find his feet, he would fall for sure, Tom was shouting, throwing his arms wide, "Ellie, honey! Ellie! Ellie!" She'd been so focused on the dog and the Chucky, he doubted she'd registered anything else.
At the sound of his voice, she turned, her eyes going huge and incredulous and so very blue, and then she was flying across the room as Mina, woofing hysterically, darted for him too. "Tom!" she shrieked. "Tom! Tom! Tom!" She'd have bowled him over, he was sure of it, because she was running so fast and his heart was so full, but he could take that, he wanted that, and she might have too. If not for Mina, beside herself with joy, who got there first.
Now, part 4 of Monsters, written by Ilza J. Bick and read by Catherine Kellgren. Chapter 103.
I like fires.
Threading on another marshmallow, Chris held his stick well above the flame's reach.
Actually, I just like s'mores.
Hey, you're burning.
Way I love them.
Licking his fingers to avoid the scorch, Peter pinched blackened, molten marshmallows onto squares of Hershey's chocolate atop a graham cracker, sandwiched this with another cracker, and pressed until the white lava of marshmallows overflowed. Peter crammed the treat into his mouth.
"And faster," he said around gooey s'more. "You going to let me get sick all by myself?"
"No," Chris said, but he brought his marshmallows no closer to the fire. He tipped a look at the night sky, milky with stars. The eye of the moon, whiter than a marshmallow, stared.
"That's not right."
Grimacing, he put a hand to a sudden ache in his chest, a weird pressure.
"I'm dreaming again." "I'm not in any rush."
The flames pulsed. Chris's breath fogged, although neither he nor Peter wore jackets or even hiking boots, just jeans, tees, sneakers.
"I like it here."
"Me too,"
Peter said, his voice gluey. His hair spilled around his shoulders like spun gold. His eyes were blue diamonds.
"One of my favorite places on Earth." "But we can't be here, can we?"
Chris thought they were on top of a mountain, high above a valley. Yet there was only the fire crackling on a table of flat rock, and nothing beyond Peter but a dark blank. Considering the stars, maybe this was outer space, or heaven.
"No, the fire's not allowed for real, but it's my space, my rules, my marshmallows."
Swallowing, Peter skimmed his tongue over a molten dribble and groaned.
"And chocolate. Oh, my God, I forgot how good that tastes. So we're in your head?"
"Pretty much. More like a daydream. My safe place. Kind of where the last part of me hangs."
Peter speared marshmallows with his stick.
"Better get a move on with that s'more before they yank you back."
"Yank me back?
How long do we have? I miss talking."
This was not what he'd wanted to say, but the truth was embarrassing. He winced at another jab of pain.
"What is that? Feels like someone's banging on my chest."
"Because he is, trying to save your ass."
"What?"
His brain caught up to what Peter had just said, and he recalled Jess's warning, or perhaps her prophecy, "Someone will die. Someone must."
"Saving my ass. You mean I'm
this close?"
Peter pinched an inch of air between two fingers.
"Heart stopped, and you're not breathing.
I think Tom might have cracked a rib. Guy from the Red Cross who did ACLS for the deputies said it happens sometimes."
"Tom?"
He blinked.
"Alex's Tom?"
"Yeah, Al..."
Peter seemed to catch himself. "Her," he said, nibbling on a marshmallow.
"You know these are good raw?
I forgot that, too. That's the hell of this. I can come here, but I'll forget you and this. It's the only way I can keep this all safe from him. It's like I'm behind this one-way mirror, only I can't mic in, and nobody outside knows I'm here."
This was so different from his previous experiences. Chris felt safer.
"Why am I not seeing you in a nightmare? That's all I've had until now,"
Chris said, thinking that he also hadn't tried dying quite so many times before, either. He stared at his stick with its marshmallows that refused to brown, and what was up with that? On impulse, he thrust the marshmallows into the flames. Nothing happened. The marshmallows didn't bubble or turn black.
Withdrawing the stick, he broke off the tip and tossed it into the fire and watched as the flames refused to claim it. A log popped, releasing a swarm of sparks, but the wood itself remained unchanged. Extending his hand, he let his palm drift close and then into the flames. No heat, no pain.
"Like I said, we're in my special place. I guess all this..."
Peter plucked up a marshmallow and stared as if studying a lab specimen. "Probably can't work for you."
"Why?"
Breaking a wedge of chocolate, Chris touched the dark wafer to his tongue. For an instant, he thought of Meg Murray sitting down to a meal that tasted of sand, while her brother, lost and already under its control, ate quite happily. The chocolate had no smell and less taste than air.
"Why haven't I been able to come here from the very beginning?"
"Maybe because you were still figuring things out, digging for the truth, putting together the pieces." Blowing out his blazing marshmallows, Peter gestured with the stick, chalking streamers of white smoke. "Letting go enough to find a piece of the real me, I guess.
Truth comes from blood and water.
Letting go of the hammer." "Yeah, but we don't need to get all biblical. This has way more to do with biology and the brain. I'm talking temporal lobe, out-of-body experiences. Isaac was right about that."
"And you? Are you really dead, or have you changed, or..."
"I think, for me, they're all related." Peter let go of a heavy sigh. "There's so much to tell you, and we don't have time for it all. I'm not sure we can even do this again."
"How are we doing it at all?"
"Dunno. I built the space a couple weeks ago when you told me to."
"Me? How could I..."
"We're different. All spared are. Some are really unique, like you and the way your brains reacted to that drug Hannah gave you. Me? I was changing before the change. The boat. Lying." Peter looked away. "Leaving that girl to drown?" He'd thought a lot about this.
"Peter, there was no time. You couldn't save them both."
He almost said someone had to die, but didn't.
"Peter, she was your sister."
"But then I made it worse. I said that girl was already dead." Peter pulled in a shuddering breath.
"The good guys don't lie. They don't choose. They save everybody." "That only happens in books. Hannah said you tried."
"Yeah." Peter gave a bleak laugh. "For all the good that did. That one choice ruined Simon's life, probably Penny's, too. And then I set up the zone. I fed." Tossing his stick into the fire, his voice thickened with disgust. "Everything I build, everyone I love, I destroy."
"I'm still here,"
Chris said quietly. He watched Peter's marshmallows turn to ash. The throbbing ache in his chest had sharpened and grown much stronger in the last few seconds.
"We're not in a nightmare. No one is here but us, and your eyes are blue, Peter."
"That's because you're seeing the piece that's..." He tapped the back of his head. "Tucked away and still, you know, me. The part you were meant to reach.
And the part I want to save if I can."
The thought popped into his head completely unbidden.
"Maybe because you want to reach me, too. You said you were afraid, but I'm here. I found this place, and you. Let me help, Peter."
"You said that once before. I think you saved me then a little. You told me to forgive myself." Peter shook his head. "But I can't."
"You shouldn't forgive me either."
"But I do, Peter," he said, then stiffened as his chest flared.
"No, please, not yet. You're not lost. Not while I can still find you.
But I'm almost gone. I can feel that, too. This space?" Peter cast his eyes around their bubble of light, holding off the dark. "I don't know how much longer I can hang on to it. Yeah, it's a part he can't control. I'm not sure he even knows about it, but he's getting stronger, and my space is shrinking. This fire, the marshmallows, they're all that's left."
"He?"
"Yes." Peter's head suddenly snapped back. An arrow of pain shot across his face.
"Peter?"
Alarmed, Chris reached for his friend. "Peter, what's..."
"No, no!"
Peter cringed.
"Don't touch me!
my fault. To name is to control. To access. Access? Control? What are you talking about? Him. He wants to know, but I haven't told.
Gasping, Peter pressed the heel of a hand to either temple.
Can't say names. Goes both ways. Naming him lets him in. Who? How? Finn. Oh, God, that hurts.
Arching against a fresh tide of pain, Peter hissed.
Using a drug. Not the same as what Hannah gave you, but close.
On whom? You?
Yes, and...
Peter snatched a gasp.
And change. Too much to explain. No time. Ask Tom. He guessed part... Ah! Peter!
It took all Chris's willpower not to touch his friend.
Peter, tell me what to do! Nothing you can do!
Another wave of pain shuddered through Peter and shook loose a moan.
Finn is coming! Coming!
Fresh sweat glistened on Peter's forehead and neck, but in the light of a fire not as bright as before. Chris tossed a glance at the dimming flames just as that sharp pain grabbed his chest again.
No time.
Either Finn had found Peter, or he was being pulled away, or maybe both.
Where? To rule?
Eyes still closed, Peter managed a nod.
He's got weapons, men, and changed.
What? A powerful talon of pain raked his chest.
Chris couldn't hold back the groan.
That familiar falling sensation was beginning, his vision fading, but he had to know this. He had to hang on.
Don't call me back. Just a few more seconds. What does he want? Kids! More exper- Ah!
Rolling to his knees, Peter clapped his hands to his head.
Get out, Chris! Please! Before he sees! Before he really- knows you. Let them take you back. Save yourself. Save.
No. Maybe it was because of his pain or Peter's terror and his certainty that when and if they met again, things would be very different. Or perhaps it was because Jess had sent him from Rule to find his way, that now Chris chose a different path. Clasping the back of Peter's neck, he pulled his friend close and held him fast.
No, Peter. I won't. Chris, don't.
Peter's eyes brimmed, and Chris saw their true color beginning to bleed. Peter's hands clung to Chris's forearms.
Don't touch me! You have to... Don't tell me what to do!
Chris heard his voice break, felt the tears on his cheeks.
I'm going to save us, Peter! I'm going to save us both!
Then the black tide swept through and carried him away. Chapter 104.
Listen to me. I've seen this man. I've seen those Chuckies. The changed, the ones he's altered. I know what they have and what they can do.
Tom pointed to the Uzi as well as the contents of the pack he'd spilled onto the table of the hospice conference room. Finn's well-armed, well-supplied, and he's got troops, and you don't. I guarantee you won't last an hour, much less a day. He'll wipe you out, then take the kids and call it even...
So you're saying we just give up, let him run over us and go down without a fight?
Scowling, Jarvis tossed a dark look at the two men, equally old and just as skeptical, who sat to either side of him.
What the hell kind of soldier are you?
Hey, hey!
Kincaid rapped from his place to Chris's left.
Are you deaf, Jarvis? This boy's trying to help us save what we can.
It's okay, Tom said,
but Chris saw the splash of angry red seep over Tom's jaw.
You're scared. You're starving. Things have fallen apart here. I get that. You don't know me, and you certainly don't trust me, especially when I show up with your public enemy number one.
Tom tilted his head toward Chris.
I get that, too. But you won't win this fight.
We have the right to defend ourselves,
Jarvis said. No one's questioning that. But you have to decide what you're truly defending.
Hell's that mean?
It means that we're not talking about fighting for Rule,
Chris rasped and winced. After 4 hours, all he could manage was a harsh whisper through a throat that felt as if he'd swallowed razor blades. What freaked him out was when he'd glanced in a mirror. A blood-encrusted, blue-black bruise circled his throat like a dog collar. The whites of his eyes were awash in red hemorrhage from broken capillaries and nearly as blood-red as what he'd seen in his dream of Peter.
Breathing hurt, the muscles grabbing with every inhale, and two cracked ribs complained, although Kincaid said busted ribs would have hurt 10 times worse.
You're just damn lucky that boy knows battlefield medicine.
Lucky for him, Tom was very strong, too. After Chris's heart started up and he was breathing again, Tom had simply scooped Chris up, hustled them all to the perimeter guards, and promptly surrendered. Although Jaden said there'd been a moment after they'd killed the girl with the corn knife when Tom had hesitated. When I said your name, you could see it in Tom's face, how surprised he was to find out who you were, and it was so weird. Tom was angry, like he already knew something about you and hated your guts. If Ellie hadn't asked him what was wrong, Jaden hadn't said the rest, but his meaning was clear, which made Chris wonder just what the hell Weller had said to Tom. He hadn't had the time to find out. For the moment, at least, Tom seemed to have swallowed his rage at Chris in favor of working together and getting these old men to listen to reason.
We're talking about defending the kids.
At his tone, his black shepherd, Jet, pushed his snout into Chris's thigh and chuffed. Chris had been so happy to see that dog, he'd nearly bawled.
That's the only fight left, Chris said, scratching the big dog's ruff. We know that, Jarvis said. Keep those bastards out of here.
No. From his seat on Chris's right, Jaden spoke up for the first time. That's not what Tom is saying. You're not listening. If Tom is right, you might as well throw the bullets. No, better yet, lob spitballs and shoot yourselves in the foot. Better use of the bullets.
Yeah? Well, I don't recall asking for your opinion, Jarvis began.
You want to yell, yell at me, Tom said patiently. I know you have no reason to trust me, but please, listen. This all makes sense, especially when you take into consideration what Weller's motives might have been and that picture of him and Finn. Blowing the mine ought to have sent the changed your way because so many are from Rule. They're your grandchildren and their friends, but they haven't showed.
That doesn't mean they've been rounded up. A few have showed.
Smoothing a hand over a rumpled gray-checked shirt, Jaeger pulled himself a little straighter, but his chest had caved in. His sallow cheeks were sunken. The canny, once bird-bright eyes were now dull and hollow.
After that business with Ben Steimke, we discovered and killed 4 more. But that's all. All that we found...
Thin, bloody fluid dribbled onto Jarvis's chin from ugly scores on either side of his mouth. Smearing the mess away with the heel of a hand, he peeked, and then ran his hand over a pant leg.
But now there's the 2 you shot, and that girl with the corn knife, and the...
He tapped his cheek.
I might have seen her around town before. Claire Kruger.
Once so bluff and round, Ernst looked like the Michelin tire guy with all the air let out.
She wasn't from Rule, but in the same year of high school as Ben. So who the hell knows how long they've been hunkered down there, Jarvis said. We pulled at least 5 bodies from that crawl space, and we've got about 12 missing in the past couple weeks, not counting the Landrys themselves. They disappeared day after that.
Jarvis shot a sidelong glance at the council, then quickly looked away, the small muscles in his jaw clenching.
That thing with Ben Steimke. Honestly, we thought people were sneaking out. Can't blame them. Tell the truth, we haven't been working real hard to keep people who want to leave. So if that's all that's come out of the mine collapse, it's nothing we can't handle.
But it's not all, Chris said in his husky, rough voice. He sounded like a chain smoker.
That's what Tom is saying.
There were a lot of kids in that mine, 200 at least, and more moving in and out, Tom said. What Weller didn't know was that Finn needed me to blow the mine to make it easier for his people to hunt them down, like herding cattle or buffalo. If only a couple have shown their faces, I bet he's rounded up quite a few. And if he's doing to them what I've seen in those altered changed, you don't stand a chance, and neither do the children.
You saying he'd kill kids? Jarvis asked. Shoot 'em or feed 'em to his changed? No. The kids are valuable, but for different reasons.
Chris had kept the details of his dream, vision, out-of-body experience to himself.
He'd experiment on them.
Tom nodded. I think that's why Melly was gathering kids.
This was never about raising an army to march on rule. It was about finding guinea pigs, experimental subjects. Finn probably wants to see what happens to normal kids, or those he can catch in the process of changing. The more I've thought about it, the more I think Finn's camp was always relatively close by, too. It's the only thing that explains why Melly fought so hard to keep us there and why the Changed never attacked. Finn protected the camp. He probably deployed men to guard our perimeter, especially once the mine was gone.
Okay, let's say you're right, but run?
Jarvis was shaking his head.
We're barely holding on now. There aren't enough supplies to go around for everybody.
Who said anything about everybody?
Chris said hoarsely. His words hung there, and Chris was content to let them. Of all the assembled men, Chris thought that from the sudden narrowing of his eyes, only his grandfather had any inkling of what they were proposing.
But
Jarvis turned a blank stare around the room.
But if we can't fight and win, he means the children.
Jaeger's gaze seemed to have regained some of its peculiar clarity.
And only the children. What are you talking about?
You can leave Rule or you can stay, but we take the kids, not you. You can't come with us,
Chris said.
You can't follow or try to find us either.
What? Jarvis spluttered. That's crazy. You'd leave us here to die?
No. If most of you want to leave, go,
Chris said.
I think you should get out of here.
Get out?
Blue veins swelled on Jarvis's temples.
Most?
Some have to stay behind, Tom said quietly. If you don't put on a show, Finn will know you've been warned. You have to buy the kids time to get out.
Wait a minute. You just said we shouldn't fight.
What I meant is it has to be the right fight for the right reason and at the right time,
Tom said. You've gathered children, some by force and others not. You've told yourselves that it's for their benefit, but a prison is not a home. Hanging on to these children serves no other purpose now but yours. They have the right to their lives. Please. Tom looked at Jarvis and then the other men in turn.
Let Jaden and Chris take them someplace safer.
No place is truly safe,
Jaeger said.
But it will be better than here,
Chris said.
We're asking for enough supplies and wagons to get the kids north, that's all. Say 4 days, 5.
That'll clean us out, Jarvis said. All we'll have will be a couple of sticks of juicy fruit.
If that's true, then you're already done, Tom said. You've got too many mouths and not enough resources.
If you can even find seed to plant, it'll be months before a harvest. Read some history. This is the starving time in Jamestown. The only thing you haven't done yet is eat your dead.
Jarvis was stony.
It would never come to that.
No one thought the world would end either, Kincaid said.
Jarvis, for God's sake. Kincaid, I can't just decide. We gotta put this to a vote. Get the village together.
You can't, Tom said. You don't have that kind of time, and people will discuss this to death. They'll panic, and you don't have the manpower to control a mob scene. Once it's done and comes down to a very simple choice, leave or stay, you'll have a much better chance of keeping people calm and maybe saving a few more lives. If I'm right, Finn is half a day behind me, but maybe a lot less. He's got the full moon working for him, too, which means he can move in and be ready to storm this place by dawn.
Lenten moon, Jaeger put in. The last full moon of winter. Appropriate, given our situation. The sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood.
He lifted his hands in apology.
Joel. Also apt, considering the earthquake. The boy is right, Jarvis. You wanted a seat on the council? Well, you are the council now. Make a decision and beg for forgiveness later, but for our Lord's sake, make the right one. My God!
Jarvis stared down at the table for a long moment, then nodded at something he saw there and looked up at Chris.
I heard what you said about the adults, but take Kincaid.
The doctor stirred.
Jarvis, I'm not asking for... The kids will need him. He's probably the only adult here you can really trust.
Jarvis's eyes shifted to Jaden.
He's taken good care of your sick before, and he's damned stubborn when it counts.
Privately, Chris had hoped they might convince Kincaid. Now he and Jaden looked at each other, and then Jaden turned to Kincaid.
"Would you come?"
Jaden asked.
"We'd like that."
Kincaid's throat clicked in a dry swallow, and then he nodded.
"Got to take care of a couple things, but okay."
"Then you need to get moving,"
Tom said. "Pack up the children, get your supplies together, and get out now. There's barely enough time as it is."
"And what do we do once you're gone?"
Jarvis asked.
"I'm not leaving," Tom said. "Not yet."
"What?"
Chris heard the word drop out of his mouth. Beside him, Jaden said, "Tom, you can't..."
"Yes, I can,"
Tom said, still looking at Jarvis. "You have your kids, and Finn's got mine."
"I can't leave.
Not while there's still a chance I can do something to help them."
"Finn wouldn't bring them,"
Chris said. "Not in the front lines. Chances are they're in the rear, 3-4 miles back. There won't be another or better opportunity to get them. Just have to keep Finn focused on Rule."
"So how do we do that?"
Jarvis asked.
"Scream and run around like chickens?"
"No. Finn's coming from the south. You have to mount a defense or put up a barricade. Maybe an abattis."
"What?"
"Trees. Cut them down so all the limbs face the enemy. Not only will your people have cover, but it will be much harder for Finn's men to get through. They'll have to go around. An obstacle like that will also keep him looking at Rule, not his rear." Jarvis glanced at the other men, who nodded.
"We can do that for you,"
Jarvis said.
"Good.
Then pick your men, Jarvis. The ones you can count on not to run at the first shot," Tom said. "And buy me some time to get my kids."
Chapter 105. The secret about what they were doing and who was coming Rule's way kept until about 3 a.m., just long enough for Chris and his people to retrieve the needed supplies and start packing up the kids, who were now gathered at the hospice. To Tom's surprise, only 50 or so oldsters, most of them refugees in Rule to begin with, elected to take a share of what supplies remained and get out of town. Of the roughly 150 elderly remaining, Jarvis had chosen 10 to man an abattis from trees they'd felled and then hastily arranged to guard the southern road, the most direct approach from the mine, which cut through rolling, sparsely forested countryside.
"I got a couple other men working on trees to barricade the north road out of town once the children are gone. Everyone else wants to wait in the church,"
Jarvis said to Tom, who'd visited the defunct school for a few very special items before heading into the church's bell tower.
"At least until Finn's in the village."
"Wait? What for? You can't be serious." Tom was horrified.
"Jarvis, you need to make people leave. They'll be sitting ducks. They should get out of Rule. This isn't Judgment Day. This isn't Jonestown. For God's sake, no one's asking you to drink Kool-Aid. They'll kill you."
"But the Rev's right. No place is truly safe."
Jarvis's eyes were so far back in his skull you needed a flashlight to see them.
"It comforts us to gather. I can't take that away. Besides, our grandchildren are finally coming home and..." His voice thickened. "They're our responsibility. Always were. If my grandson's with Finn, I need to know he's at peace."
No amount of argument changed the old man's mind, or anyone else's, and Tom finally gave up. Later, crossing the square to the village hall, Tom spotted people trickling into the church. The stained glass windows shimmered with color, something he'd have found calming on any other night. As he mounted the village hall steps, the faint strains of a hymn wound through the open church doors.
"I fear no foe with thee at hand to bless."
Bum leg nagging a touch from all the up and down, not to mention wrestling plastic primer buckets and bags of high-grade fertilizer into a back storage room just above the jail before humping back for cans of diesel and fuel oil and hoping he really did have the proportions down, he headed downstairs to check out the building's air conditioning ducts. He'd already found they were just large enough for him to worm through. Thank God he wasn't claustrophobic. Now, to figure out how far he could stretch that debt cord and if the math worked.
All he needed to buy were 15, 20 lousy minutes on the outside, and then the darkness will deepen, Tom thought, whether we like it or not. 2 hours later, he heard the clump of boots.
Tom?
Up here, Chris, to your left. Hold on. He was flat on his back on a high shelf, a partially dismantled alarm clock in his hands, the jail's ceiling a foot from his face. Wedging a finger on the clock's escape wheel, he carefully seated a sliver of whittled matchstick between one tooth and the lever's entry pallet before slowly easing pressure on the wheel. The pallet fit into the wood but didn't break it. The clock's gears were still, the hands frozen. So, Tom said, gently laying the clock aside and picking up a pair of crimpers. Guys at the barricade set?
About as ready as they can be. Kids should be away in another hour.
Cutting it close. Going to be dawn soon.
Can't be helped.
Chris was taking in the tanks of propane, cans of gasoline, premix.
I knew all this stuff was here, but what you're planning gives me a whole different perspective.
Yep, just got to hope it's enough of a bang. Coring a hole in the end of a grayish-white block, he slipped in a slim length of tarnished pipe. Yes, close enough to pass for an M18, a lucky break. Then used his teeth to tear strips of black electrical tape. You got your guys?
What's left? There weren't many of us spared to begin with, and even fewer now. Prue and Greg are the oldest. I'd send both, but I held Greg back to go with us. There are some guys, Aiden and Lucian and Sam. After I left, they went over to the dark side, you know, locking up Prue and Greg. I don't trust Aiden and his guys, but can't leave them. Wouldn't be right.
Your people, your call. But you really want them for the long haul? Eventually you'll have to choose.
I know, Chris shrugged. We're all spared. If we make it, that might be the time to give them a share and cut them loose. Anyway, Prue and three other guys will go after your kids when we say.
Excellent. Tom gestured at a thermos on the floor. Coffee, if you want. I've been mainlining for hours. I'm so jacked I'm vibrating.
Thanks.
Uncapping the thermos, Chris poured out a cup, sipped, then blinked.
Wow, that's strong. I think my teeth just curled.
Enjoy it while it lasts. Found it in Weller's stuff. Tom returned his attention to his work. That sea of red hemorrhage in Chris's eyes, so like Finn's altered change, unsettled him. You sound better.
Yeah. Kincaid said I was lucky my larynx didn't fracture.
He heard Chris take another halting swallow.
How's this going to work exactly?
Going to wire the block to an alarm clock, the way I already have four others. Once I pull the matchstick, clock's ticking. But this way, I can control exactly when we start instead of setting it now and then hoping we get lucky.
Won't they hear it from the door? The ticking?
Chris gestured with a finger at a finished bomb attached to a bottom shelf.
That one's in plain view.
Something interesting for Finn to look at. I'm betting they won't have time to yank them all before one blows, he said, amazed at how smoothly the lie flowed from his tongue.
Wow. They really teach you guys a lot.
Chris ran a forefinger over the cup's rim.
I saw this movie about this bomb disposal squad. You did stuff like that?
Yeah. Tom used his knife to flay electrical cord. The more jury-rigged this looked, all the better to fool Finn.
I know the movie. Did they get it right?
Some. Most of the time we sent in robots and built water charges or used a hunk of C4 to blow IEDs. The suit's a last resort. He paused. I'm not trying to be an asshole, but I really don't want to talk about it right now. I have to stay focused. Going back there in my head, it's nowhere good.
Okay.
He felt Chris's eyes.
What did Weller say?
He knew what Chris meant. Nothing very nice, he said, ripping another long piece of electrical tape. Thank goodness there was plenty. He'd worried he might not have enough for the real thing. This isn't how I imagined we would meet.
Oh?
Chris's voice grew cautious.
How was that?
I was going to kill you. He smoothed tape with the flat of his thumb. For what Weller said you did to Alex. After the mine went, killing you was all I could think about. it was a poison? He felt his tongue test that, then shook his head. That's not right. It was the only thing I had to hang on to, that hate. Hate makes you feel more powerful, like you can keep yourself pumped, so you put one foot in front of the other, thinking that you're going somewhere, even if all you're doing is looping the same movie over and over in your head, of how you were going to kill me. Technicolor. He nodded. This afternoon, well, yesterday now, when Jaden called you by name, I thought, Jesus, it's him. This is the guy I've come to kill. Sighing, Tom folded his hands over his chest. When he was a kid, he used to lie like this in sweet-smelling grass and study clouds. There was a second there when I thought, fine, let him die. There was a long pause.
What changed your mind?
Ellie. He rolled his head to look down. She was frantic. It finally dawned on me that Weller told so many lies. What he said about you might be just one more. A brief smile flickered over Chris's lips.
Thanks for giving me the benefit of the doubt.
You're welcome. Despite the weeks nurturing the monstrous blight in his soul, Tom liked this boy. In another time and place, they might be good friends. He felt a brush of sadness that now the chances were nil. He had so many questions and no time. He wanted to ask about Alex, each memory, how she looked, what she said. He even thought he could take it if Chris and Alex... But did that matter now? Nothing could change how he felt about Alex. Nothing. And he still had the miracle of Ellie, too. So sweet. A final gift. Hang on to that. Everything that happened next would hinge on Chris, a boy he'd dreamt about so often and barely knew.
Hold on to Ellie and Alex until the very last second.
Kids are about ready, Chris said. We should go.
Yeah. Showing the other boy a tight smile, Tom tore off a few strips of electrical tape and began strapping the alarm clock to the gray-white block he'd fashioned. Not a bad looker, if he did say so himself. Ought to kick-start a couple hearts. Few more seconds.
Okay.
Chris was quiet a moment.
You ever wonder who did it?
Did what? The EMPs? He shook his head. If this was a book or movie, there'd be some guy who'd explain it, give you all the answers, tidy everything up, wrap it with a bow. We'll never know, and it doesn't matter. This is like war, Chris. When the soldiers come marching in, all you care about is protecting your family. When your boots on the ground, all you think about is the mission and your buddies, your brothers. It's not political. There's no big picture. You don't agonize over the morality. Everything narrows down to the essentials. Yeah, some days, the impossible days when no matter how careful you are, someone will die, you wonder what it's all for. But in the end, there are your brothers, your people, and only that. You're not looking to die, but you'll sacrifice it all for them. I lost that for a while, too. When I went on leave, got stateside. He paused, wondering if he really wanted to admit this out loud, and then thought that, hell, in a few more hours, nothing he said now would matter. I was on the fence, maybe a step away from never going back, deserting. Had it all mapped out, too. How I would lay tracks in Michigan, but then work my way over on the sly into Minnesota, and then Canada. Big country, easy to get lost. But my best friend, Jim, we were on the same EOD team. I bet he knew something was up when I mentioned the Waccamaw. My family was in Maryland. There are plenty of nice places to camp there. So why was I going to the UP? I think that's why Jim invited himself along, to remind me of my brothers, my people. But then, the world died, and it just wasn't an issue anymore.
Would you have gone back if nothing had happened?
I'll never know, will I? I'd like to think that I would have. But then I found... He swallowed back the lump. Found my people, anyway. Found Alex and Ellie. For a little while, I got back what I'd lost. So to hell with the rest, Chris. How this happened, who did it. All I care about, all that matters, is that Alex and Ellie helped me find myself again. Chris was silent a long moment.
"It was the whistle, Tom,"
he said quietly. "What?" For just a second, he'd been back in the Walker Mall, striding in with an armload of wood as Alex looked up with a smile that found its way into his chest. "What are you talking about?"
"Alex,"
Chris said, shaking out the dregs before carefully twisting the cup back onto the thermos.
"She ran because of the whistle."
He remembered the high, impossible note that pierced his heart. "How do you know?" Screwing on that cap seemed to take all Chris's concentration.
"Ellie told me. She gave the whistle to a boy we brought back from Oren. I think her idea was that if Alex and you were in Rule, Alex would put it together that Ellie was somewhere up there, and you guys would go get her. So if Alex had a whistle at the mine, she must have found hers on that boy. Too much of a coincidence otherwise, isn't it? Alex left to go after Ellie. I got here too late, and the rest was just..."
Chris tightened the cap.
"Lousy timing. Or good timing for Jess, I guess. If I'd gotten back sooner, I might have saved Alex. Knowing Jess, though, probably not. One way or the other, Jess was bound and determined that Alex should go, and then me, too."
He didn't know how he was supposed to feel.
"Why are you telling me this?"
Chris's violent red eyes met his.
"It's the end of the world, Tom. Rule is done. I don't know if we have a tomorrow, so there's one thing you need to get clear in your head. You found your people, and you never lost them. Alex left because she wasn't sure she could count on me to help her. Knowing how I was back then, she'd have been right. But I don't think she would have felt the same way about you, Tom,"
Chris said.
"Not then, or ever."
Dawn was an hour away, more or less, as Chris walked the now empty hospice halls. All the terminal patients with whom he'd spent time were long dead. Illuminated only by moonlight, the halls were sultry with shadows. He slowed as he approached the only occupied room left. Through the open door came a light floral perfume, but the rest was silence. Hesitating a moment, he quietly rounded the corner and saw first the woman on the bed, and then, belatedly, a figure huddled in a large bedside chair.
"Oh, I'm sorry,"
he said, already beginning to back out.
"I didn't know..."
"No, no."
Between the soft upholstery and a blanket, his grandfather looked gnomish. His bald scalp gleamed in a splash of silver-green moonlight that cut his face into deep black wedges and taut skin over stark ridges of bone.
"You're not disturbing me. Leaving soon?"
"Yes. Sarah and Jayden are still settling the kids, but soon,"
Chris said.
"What about you?"
"I'm staying a while longer with Tom. We'll leave together."
Although Chris had a very bad premonition he couldn't put into words or quite shake, leaving wouldn't be quite so simple.
"Well, come in," Yeager said, beckoning. "You don't need my permission."
Chris crossed to stand over the bed. The silence was eerie. Jess lay on her back, hands curled over her stomach because the small muscles had atrophied with disuse. Someone had brushed her hair, which spilled over the pillow and her shoulders. Kincaid, probably. In the moonlight, the whites showed through her lashes in thumbnail slivers. Chris kept expecting her to say something, or those lids to snap open and to see himself captured in those black mirror eyes. The prolonged bout of REM sleep that had seized Jess for weeks had ended abruptly only a half hour ago, Kincaid said. Chris had felt only a mild shock when the doctor showed him the book from which he'd gleaned the drug's formula, Ghost Walkers, the Ethnobotanical Encyclopedia of Medicinal and Psychoactive Mushrooms. In another half hour, and probably less because Kincaid hadn't stinted on the dose this time, Jess would be past dreams.
"Would you like to sit?"
Yeager indicated a chair with a bony hand that jutted from an arm as thin as a chopstick, his clothing puddled.
"We haven't talked."
It was on the tip of his tongue to point out that he'd been in cardiac arrest part of the time and busy the rest, but he let that fizzle. The last time he'd seen this old man, his grandfather had smacked him around. Taking a seat also made him uneasy, as if he'd be conceding something, maybe getting himself under this old man's thumb.
"What for? I don't have anything to say. I don't forgive you, if that's what you want. You and the Council let terrible things happen. I don't even care about whose idea it was first, because if it was Peter's, you should have said no. If it was yours, then you took advantage of Peter, and that's even worse. You had every chance to stop this, but you didn't. You didn't even save Kincaid, a friend. You let Aiden take his eye, for God's sake. What could you say that will make any of that better, or even justify it?"
"Nothing," Jaeger said, his tone void of emotion, but not indifferent or cold. "But I thought you might have questions. Like I said, then I have one. How is my brother?"
"Last time I saw him, he was pretty sick from smoke inhalation, which was totally my fault."
"I'm sorry for that. We haven't always seen eye to eye, but I admire him for setting up a place for children who wanted a different life from their parents. He always did want to help."
"He helped me when I was hurt. It's a long story."
Coming back from the dead wasn't a subject he wanted to broach with this old man.
"How much did he tell you?"
"Pretty much everything. Some stuff I figured out on my own."
"Ah. Do you have questions?"
"Oh, about a million." Although he'd resolved that it didn't matter, that it was water under the bridge, he couldn't help being curious.
"Yes. How did you decide? Between me and Simon, I mean."
Jaeger knit his skeletal hands together. If he'd had a sickle, he could have passed as the Grim Reaper.
"To be honest, I chose the infant on the right."
"What do you mean?"
"I could only take one. Your mother was holding you both at the time, and she cradled you on the left."
"What does that have to do with anything?" The mention of his mother stung. He heard the sharpness, his simmering anger, and decided, screw it. What difference did the side make?
"Oh..."
Jaeger drew a slow hand over his bald scalp, the gesture of a man who'd once had hair to smooth.
"Because Christ sits on God's right hand, I suppose, if you want something scriptural. But it's mystical, really. Goes back to the Jews. For them, the body's two sides mirror the divided nature of our soul. There is the power to give and hold back. The right hand is stronger. You give with your right, whether it's justice or kindness. With your left, you hold back. The left hand is discipline and restraint. The left hand keeps its secrets
and lives in the shadows." His grandfather had just described him and his life to a T.
"So you went for strength?"
"I chose the sword." Jaeger paused.
"But in my arrogance, I forgot that it takes just as much strength to refrain, be slow to anger and rash action. It's easy to trick yourself into thinking that in the righteousness of your anger, cruelty is justified. But you were strong, Chris, much stronger than I've given you credit for."
"I'm not strong," Chris said. Yet of all the things he remembered about Rule, a place where he thought he might finally find a home, the mornings after a fight were the most vivid, kneeling next to Peter in church as everyone, including Alex, especially Alex, looked on and feeling his grandfather's hands on his head in blessing. It was hokey and stupid and incredibly sexist, and yet he had felt pride.
"This is what it's like not to be afraid. This is what it feels like to belong."
He was like Tom, wasn't he?
"Looking for my people."
Except Alex was gone, and if his dreams held true, Peter was worse than dead. A strange lump forced its way into his throat. He should go. No way he'd break down now. He didn't forgive Jaeger. He couldn't. Chris could let go of the hammer for Peter, but never for this old man.
"Sometimes I wait too long, and then it's too late."
"But you never broke, Chris. You're following your path and still finding your way. Take it from an old man. Sometimes you get a second chance."
"Not with Alex."
What he said next surprised him.
"What do I do about Simon? If he's alive, we're enemies. Did he even know about me?"
Jaeger shook his head.
What you do depends on what you find.
He eats people. He's my brother. We're identical twins. He's me and I'm him.
If that is all he is, then you have your answer, don't you?
How can he be more than that?
I love him, Chris.
Too dark to see his grandfather's expression, Chris heard the catch in his voice.
That makes him more.
That Jaeger could not say the same about him hurt him more than Chris would have imagined. Well, what did he expect? He'd shown up in town a virtual stranger, only a copy, a faded Xerox.
Try not to be bitter for too long, Jaeger said. Life is hard enough.
Whose fault is that? I was a kid. I saw you, what, 5 times before the world blew up? It was Peter who really cared, who went out of his way.
He swallowed back the rest.
How else am I supposed to feel?
You're entitled to your anger.
I don't need your permission.
But you're not stupid, Chris. Of all people, you should know what anger does to the soul. You have only to remember your father.
Chris stared.
You're going to lecture me about anger and my dad? You knew what he was like. It's why you agreed to take Simon in the first place. You were rich. You could have fixed things, done something to get me out of there. But you left me alone with him. So don't give me any bullshit about what anger does. I don't forgive you. That's what you're really asking for, so you can die and believe everything's all right. What you did and let happen, to me, to Peter, Alex, those are your mistakes, your sins to bear. Know what? Take it up with God if you see him.
It is the time of the Lord's vengeance, and he will pay her what she deserves. Jeremiah was referring to Babylon, not rule, but I take your point. You asked about Simon. There really is only one choice you'll need to make. Life or death.
Someone will die.
Chris looked back at Jess.
Someone must. I need to go, he said. Kids are moving out soon.
All right.
Jaeger peered up at him.
Why did you come? You've made it abundantly clear it wasn't to see me.
I've been thinking a lot about Jess, I guess.
Now it was his turn to pause.
Why did you think it was okay? She was married, so were you. You're a reverend.
Oh.
His grandfather brushed an errant strand of hair from Jess's forehead.
The heart wants what it wants, and only I was married. I was selfish, and she was vulnerable, beautiful, a widow. At least, we thought so. Her husband had been declared legally dead.
A mistake. Or did he really disappear?
Perhaps a bit of both. Even before Vietnam, he was involved in some very questionable projects.
Jaeger's hand lingered on Jess's cheek.
When did you figure it out?
Technically, he'd known ever since Peter mentioned the name in a dream. But that wasn't something you could say, even to a guy who believed in the two halves of the soul.
When Tom showed us the picture, Isaac said he was a business partner, and then I remembered that it's the only mine shaft that was never finished,
Chris said.
That's when I knew that Jess had been Finn's wife.
No! Clutching her savage in one tight fist, Ellie stamped a foot, then pushed Mina's snout away when the dog turned a worried look. Please don't make me. I want to stay with you. Why can't I?
Ellie, honey.
While very bright, the moon kept ducking in and out of scudding high clouds, and he was having a hard time seeing her face. Crouching, Tom ducked his head, trying to catch her eyes.
Go easy. She's grown up a lot, but she's still only 8. Look at me.
You have to listen. It won't be safe here.
But I don't want to go with them.
She waved an arm in the general direction of the wagons parked in the hospice's lot. From here, the wagons would head north on an old logging road that could be easily blocked once they were gone. The air was filled with the clatter of hooves on icy asphalt, the anxious whimpers and yips of the remaining dogs, and the piping exclamations and questions from the children. Most were under 12 and being hustled to one of 2 waiting wagons. To Tom's left, a bald kid with more piercings than a pincushion was boosting an egg-headed boy onto a flatbed where Sarah, a slender girl with a touch of a limp, waited.
"You know Jaden," he said.
"That's not what I mean. I should stay. I can help," Ellie said. "So can Mina."
At the sound of her name, the dog's tail whisked.
"We shouldn't split up, Tom. We only just..."
"I know, honey."
He leaned forward a little to make himself heard over the axes biting trees and handsaws buzzing through trunks. Once the children were away, the trees would be felled to prevent Finn's men from using the road. A large force would have to bushwhack miles out of its way to follow. If Finn was up to chasing anyone, Tom was betting against it.
"But I have to stay. If you're still here, I'll worry about you, and then I won't be able to do my job."
"But why does it have to be you? Why can't somebody else stay?"
"Chris is staying."
He wasn't wild about that, but Chris wouldn't back down.
"Your plan, my town, and you'll need help."
Best not to fight it, though. The first chance he got, he'd send Chris packing.
"I'm the only one who can do this, Ellie. This is the way I can keep you safe."
At the growing thunder in her expression, he cupped her face in his hands. "You and Alex were the best things to ever happen to me. I thought I'd lost you, and then there you were, like this miracle. I was so happy I thought I was going to burst. I would do anything for you. I know this is hard, but please, do this for me."
"Tom," Ellie blinked furiously, "I don't have anything to give you to keep you safe. Chris has my good luck charm. I don't have anything else."
"Oh, honey."
He kissed first her right palm and then her left before pressing her small hands to his chest.
"You're right here. That's all I need."
"But what about Alex?"
He worked around the tightness in his throat.
"She's there, too. She'll always be."
"But I want her for real, Tom. Promise we'll look for her together?"
She raised her streaming face.
"Please? Cross your heart and hope to die?"
For the second time in less than 5 minutes, he lied.
"Cross my heart," and
he saw Chris downslope running their way. The boy's body language was enough.
"This is it. You have to go, honey."
Scooping Ellie into his arms, he jogged to Sarah's wagon and boosted her in. "I'll be there as soon as I can."
"Tom!"
Ellie grabbed Mina, who topped in after, by the neck.
"Tom, wait!"
"I'll be there," he repeated,
then ran to the lead wagon, crowded with kids and dogs. Jaden was slinging a backpack to Kincaid, who was settling a teary girl and admonishing a silky golden retriever that kept trying to wash the girl's face.
"You guys gotta roll," Tom said.
"I hear that."
Kincaid leaned down and grasped Tom's hand.
"Luck. Stay safe, son.
Right back at you."
Tom offered a hand to Jaden.
"Be careful.
Watch out for Ellie."
"Watch her yourself."
Jaden surprised him by pulling Tom into an embrace.
"I never thanked you," the boy said roughly, "for, you know..." "It's okay."
Tom gave the boy a squeeze. "Good luck."
"Don't be long."
Jaden clung to Tom's forearms.
"Stick with Chris. He's got a radio. I'll keep mine on so you two know where to find us. Don't get any dumb, stupid ideas, Tom."
Had Jaden read something in his face?
"Don't worry. Now go."
Turning, he saw Chris at Ellie's wagon, reaching up to give the girl a hug. Chris's big black shepherd leapt nimbly alongside Mina, and a sleek Weimaraner Chris said had belonged to Alex. Seeing them all together like that, knowing Ellie would be cared for and loved, made Tom feel a little easier. Beyond, a large dray hitched to a third supply wagon was snorting, picking up on the sudden urgency and eager to be off. Three other boys, Aiden, Sam, and Greg, were already on their horses. Aiden and Sam, who smelled like bad news, moved to take point, while Greg waited to bring up the rear.
"Please, God."
As Ellie's wagon rumbled past, he raised a hand. He thought Ellie shouted something, but her words were drowned by the clop of horses' hooves and the creak of wagons and the few excited huffs of dogs.
"Please keep her safe."
In another moment, the moon hid its face, thick shadows swallowed the wagon, and Ellie was gone from him again, lost to the dark. Chapter 106.
How long are we going to stay here?
Cindy asked the guard. She curled against Luke the way he remembered his cat used to. Warmth-seeking behavior, his mom called it. Luke used to hate how much that cat shed, but now he really missed the dumb thing, not to mention his parents. Slipping an arm around Cindy's shoulders, he pulled her a little closer. A half hour after Finn's men and their Chuckies had streamed into camp, two more men had trotted up, leading a mare. When Luke spotted her and an ashen Chad astride the horse, he'd made an idiot of himself, twisting away from Melly and capturing Cindy in a bear hug.
I thought you were dead! I thought you were dead!
Sup to the boss, the guard said, tipping coffee into a camp mug.
Half a smoke was glued to the guard's lower lip. Exhaling a gray jet, he sipped, sighed, pulled in another drag, and said in a strangled voice,
"Wouldn't mind some decent sleep when this is done, though."
"So were it rule?"
Luke waved away fumes. The way these guys smoked, they should chew burnt logs and get over it already. This particular old guard sported a ratty mustache so saturated with nicotine it was dirty orange.
"Are we staying here? What about the kids in rule?"
"You ask too many questions, you know that?"
Turning away with a lazy shrug, the mustachioed guard hooked a thumb under the carry strap of his Uzi.
"If I was you kids," he said, sauntering toward a much larger fire and the other three guards, all of them sucking cancer sticks, "I'd get some sleep instead of freezing your asses. Gonna be light in about an hour."
From his place opposite Luke, Chad muttered,
"Yeah, well, it's my ass to freeze, buttface."
Sighing, he stirred a steaming MRE, listlessly chewed a mouthful of macaroni and cheese, then dropped the spoon into the pouch.
"Stomach's too jumpy."
To Chad's left, Jasper piped up,
"You going to finish that?"
"How can you eat?"
Cindy asked.
"I'm hungry."
Jasper shoveled in a huge mouthful.
"Too wired to sleep,"
he said, his voice clogged by cheesy noodles.
"This has to be it. I mean, he took all the Chuckies."
He gestured with the spoon to a large stainless steel animal cage standing empty on a flatbed slotted in with the other wagons.
"Even those guys."
"So if this is rule," Cindy said, "and those kids are still there, what will they do with us now? Do you think they'll... that they might..."
"No," Luke said, and put both arms around her. He wanted to say something movie tough, like Finn's guys would have to get through him first, but the words just wouldn't come.
"But we should make a move."
Chad tossed a look over his shoulder to check for the guards, then leaned closer.
"We're the three oldest. There's four of them, three of us."
"Hey,"
Jasper said around a mouthful of macaroni.
"I'm here."
"You're 10. Keep eating." Chad rolled his eyes. "If we can get guns..."
"Yeah, well, if is a pretty big word right now," Luke said.
"But we're just sitting here. I don't see that we can do anything else." "I agree with Chad."
When Luke looked down at her, Cindy continued in a whisper,
"Except for those guards, everyone else is gone. We'll probably never have a better shot."
"And go where, Cindy?"
Luke asked.
"Anywhere. Luke, we could raid the supply wagons, grab some guns and food, and go. Cindy, we have 30 kids. Us three and a couple other guys can handle a gun, and that's it. How would we move everyone and all the stuff we need? We can't outrun Finn."
"But I don't like waiting around for Finn to decide what happens next."
Chad jerked his head at the transport cage.
"You want to end up in one of those?"
"No, I don't,"
Luke said to Chad.
"But staying alive beats dying."
"Not if we end up like Peter,"
Jasper said. After 5 days with Finn and his weird Chuckies, who were exactly like the girl Tom had fought weeks ago, Luke had a queasy sense of what was in store. Peter was too old to be a Chucky, older than Tom for sure by a couple years, but his eyes were raving red, and God, he ate what the Chuckies did, thawed slabs of frozen oldsters stacked like cordwood in a special Chucky chuck wagon, which meant that Finn had probably given Peter the same crap Tom figured someone fed those Chuckies in white. Only it hadn't worked on Peter, who spent half his time in his cage screaming,
"Let me go! Let me go! Let me go! Go! Go!" And the other half trying to get at Finn. Sometimes Finn hurt him pretty bad. Never laid a hand on Peter, but wow, a couple seconds with Finn and that creepy Davy, who followed Finn everywhere like a dog, and Peter was moaning, howling, clutching his head. It's like he hears something. When Luke turned his gaze away from the transport cage, Cindy said, "You know, when Peter starts up with the let me go stuff, but how? He's only half a Chucky, you know?"
"But crazy," Chad said.
"Not all the time," Luke said. "All this stuff, the go, 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 that usually starts up whenever Finn moves out."
"Telepathy?"
Cindy asked.
"Can't be straight telepathy."
Swallowing the last of the mac and cheese, Jasper licked the plastic spoon. "At least not like the movies, or what you're thinking."
"What else could it be?
You were at the barn." What had happened when Finn's Chuckies descended on their camp scared Luke silly, how they broke formation, half going left, and the rest like a marching band at halftime streaming to the right. Then the Chuckies had done nothing, only waited, staring, their concentration utterly complete. It was so quiet that Luke could hear the crackle of the fire and the jangle of hardware as horses tossed their heads. It was the weirdest thing. But Luke sensed that the Chuckies were being held back. Yes, they'd wanted him, they'd wanted Melly. What they'd most hungered after was all those juicy kids huddled in the barn.
But they weren't allowed. They were like puppets?
That wasn't quite right. It was as if something or someone held them back on invisible leashes, this far and no farther.
"Yeah, but have you ever tried following your own thoughts? Real complicated."
Smoothing the empty MRE pouch on his thighs, Jasper began rolling the plastic into a tight tube.
"Plus, you have the problem of signal strength and complexity."
Luke and Cindy looked at each other. "What are you talking about?" Luke asked.
"Thoughts are, you know, jumbly," Jasper said.
"Okay, so?" Jasper gave him a hello. "Look,
what does Peter do? Does he talk about a gazillion things? No. He keeps saying the same thing over and over again. Go, 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 let me go."
"Yeah, but he's crazy," Chad said.
"Not all the time."
Jasper peered through the tube he'd made like a pirate with a spyglass.
"He's worse when the Chuckies are on the move. Other times he's normal."
"He eats people," Cindy said. "His eyes are weird."
"Okay, not normal normal, but not all Chucky, either. Whenever Finn does take him along, Peter's either tied up or with a couple guards."
"Probably because Finn can't control him very well," Luke said.
"Or all the way, yeah. And the times Finn's left him here, Peter's not as loud and crazy. He gets better the longer Finn's gone. I think it's a cumulative exposure and distance thing, like, you know, Wi-Fi."
"What?"
"So," Luke asked, and then as Jasper swiveled still with the tube to his eye, added, "Would you quit that? It's annoying."
"Fine," Jasper heaved a long-suffering sigh.
"I don't think Peter's saying let me go, like let me out of this cage so I can go home. He might mean let me go, go, go after them. Go, go, go is the command. Maybe all Finn does are simple commands, piggybacked on other signals."
"I don't even know what that means," Cindy said.
"Yeah, the Chuckies aren't radios," Chad said.
"Radios." Luke turned that over. "Wi-Fi. Something important there. Something Jasper said about signal strength. Not just distance, but something else."
"Guys, what do you think a thought is?" Jasper said.
"Electrical impulses, that's all. The body's full of electricity. You've got gradients across your skin and ion flow in cells."
"What?"
Cindy said.
"So how does that work in this situation?"
"Well, thoughts are chemical and electrical."
"I don't know."
Jasper's shoulders rose and fell.
"Look, I can't tell you how Finn's doing it, but he can't be slinging real complicated stuff around. Or if he is, only a couple Chuckies get the whole thing. Maybe even just one Chucky."
"Whoa, wait a sec,"
Cindy sat up.
He's right. Two groups of Chuckies. The ones in white and everybody else,
Chad said. Like, maybe it doesn't work with every Chucky? Or he doesn't need a ton to get the job done, Luke said. But he's limited by distance, like when your Wi-Fi drops out when you're too far from a network. He kept thinking, signal strength and a network. Okay, I buy that, but... Chad threw up his hands. So what? We're still stuck. Luke didn't see how this helped either, but his head felt like he'd spent all night cramming for a test he was sure to bomb. Sometimes when he walked away from a problem, the answer popped into his head. I'm going for water. As he stood, all four guards perked up. Water, he said, holding up his canteen and giving it a shake.
Hold on.
Heaving to his feet, the mustachioed guard lumbered over. A lit cigarette jutted from his mouth.
All right, let's go, he said, handing over a flashlight.
It's not like I'm going to run anywhere, Luke complained, but the guard only grunted and made a get-going gesture with the Uzi. The stream was beyond the kids' tents and a short distance into the woods. Following his flashlight, Luke ducked into the trees where the light was worse and the shadows thicker. Ahead, he heard the churn of water over stones. The final 20 feet to the stream took a sharp drop.
I ain't going down there. Bad for my knees. Make it quick, the guard said as the orange coal of his smoke danced. Freezing my ass.
Oh, bite me. Carefully picking his way over stones and scrims of ice, Luke fanned the light over the sparse snow along the stream's edge, looking for a safe spot where he wouldn't wind up wet. As the beam flickered past a splotch of slush, he spotted something that only registered when his light had already skimmed past. Puzzled, he turned the beam back and saw two things. Snow heaped around a rock where all the rest nearby were still covered, and a trio of animal prints. Probably an animal had disturbed the snow as it stepped past. From the prints, at first glance, he thought, wolf. Huge, too. That print was bigger than his hand, and fresh, as in not long ago. Considering that, all of a sudden, he was glad for the guard and his gun. Make this quick is right. The last thing he needed to run into was a hungry wolf. He had enough problems. Heart pounding, he swiveled right, dragging his light over a curving meander, and froze when two green coins flared alongside the silver oval of a face. The green eyes belonged to a honking, huge gray-white wolf, but the face belonged to a girl. Chapter 107 Luke was so freaked a scream fizzed into his throat that he just as quickly bottled behind clamped teeth. The impulse to turn and run was so strong the flashlight jittered from a sudden fit of the shakes. The wolf didn't move, but the girl did, raising a warning finger to her lips and then crooking her hand the way Morpheus had to Neo, not bring it on, but come here. For a split second he thought, oh, you've got to be kidding. This was like the wolf in Little Red Riding Hood. Get near a strange kid who was just the right age to be a Chucky? Hell no. Then he considered that this girl was, A, hiding, and B, with an animal, and that except for Finn's weirdo Chuckies, all the ones he knew were the kind who snacked first and asked questions later.
Kid, what the...
The mustached guard's voice was lost as the guy hacked, then hawked up something from deep in his chest. He spit and then croaked,
damn coffin nails!
Louder,
what's the holdup?
Luke dragged up his voice from his toenails. The girl was shaking her head.
There's a lot of ice. Be up in a couple seconds.
The guard muttered something, and Luke thought the guy might come down after all. But then a flame leapt as the guard lit up a fresh smoke. Turning, he saw that the girl was now only a foot away, her wolf, or maybe a really big husky or something, at attention by her side.
Who are you? He whispered. How many guards? She murmured.
Now that she was closer, he thought she must be around 17, 18, and decked out in a funky, fluttery camo jacket, the hood cinched down tight, accentuating high cheekbones, a narrow nose, and strong jaw. The sharp dash of a widow's peak was just visible high on her forehead, but he couldn't tell what color her hair was. Her eyes, though, were an intense, deep emerald green, as bright as the wolf's. From her clothing and roughed hands, not to mention that Springfield she was packing and the sheathed knife strapped to either leg, he thought she'd been in the woods on her own for a long time. She looked like a wild wolf girl.
Four. One here, three back at the tents.
He paused.
Are you from Rule?
She shook her head.
Weapons? Uzis, and they all have pistols.
A deep wrinkle formed between her eyebrows.
Can you handle a gun?
When he nodded, she said,
Get the guard to come down.
It was on the tip of his tongue to ask what she was going to do. Then he considered how that was just dumb. Nodding, he stood and called,
Hey, I need some help down here. I...
What the hell? The guard said, bored, no question in his tone at all. What happened?
Luke injected a note of misery.
I fell in, he said, then plunged his hand into ice water and splashed around, and my boot came off. I can't find it, and...
Oh, Jesus!
An exasperated sigh, followed by the clop of heavy feet.
Hang on.
Thanks.
Luke managed a pathetic note. He risked a quick peek with the light, but the girl and her humongous wolf, or dog, or whatever, had vanished. Swiveling, he pegged his flashlight beam to the guard, who was working his way down in a crabbing sidestep. Too late, he remembered.
Shit, I'm supposed to have lost my boot.
Hey,
he said, then dropped to his knees, angling his light until the beam splashed directly into the guard's face.
Over here!
Jesus, kid!
Squinting, the guard put up both hands to shield his eyes. A fresh cigarette was screwed into his mouth.
Move the light! You're gonna—
Luke saw the girl, who must have scrambled higher until she was well above the guard, suddenly rear into view like an actor caught in the flare of a full spot. Her elbows were cocked, and then she was jabbing fast. The butt of her Springfield hit the guard's skull with a loud thunk. The old man grunted a short "Ugh!" His cigarette shot away from his mouth, the orange eyes streaking like a comet. The guard's feet tangled, but he was already unconscious, completely limp, only his momentum tumbling him face first to a skidding stop just short of the water.
Whoa!
For a stunned second, Luke could only stare as the girl swiftly stripped the guard of his Uzi and passed over the handgun to him. Standing, she let out a loud cough at the same moment she cranked back the Uzi's bolt, the metallic crick-crack lost in the noise.
I really don't want to risk shots,
she whispered, then suddenly winced. A hand snuck to her temple, and she swayed as if from a sudden shove.
The sound will...
She broke off with a harsh grunt.
Are you okay?
He reached an automatic hand, but reconsidered when the wolf, obviously sensing the girl's discomfort, whined and then nosed the girl's thigh. She looked like someone had just clocked her, but her expression was eerie, something he'd seen before. Then he had it. She looked a little like Peter when Finn lobbed one of his brain bomb things. Luke let his hand drift back to his side, suddenly unsure she wouldn't go just as apeshit. Maybe she was a Finn experiment who'd escaped.
I'm fine.
A tight smile died midway to her mouth. Sprawled at their feet, the felled guard snored. Kneeling, she turned the old man's head until his breathing quieted.
Who are you? Where'd you come from?
Been following you the last 2 days, she said. Her wolf was, he thought, some kind of half-breed, a cross between a wolf and a malamute or huge husky. Had to wait until they moved out. Buck? Turning, she patted her leg, and the wolf dog eeled to her side.
All right,
she said, jerking her head toward the slope. Get as many down here as you can. How do I do that? Now a true smile, as fleeting as a swift high cloud, touched her lips.
Panic.
Help! Help!
And then, while Cindy was still digesting that, Luke followed the cry with a screech that raised the hairs on her arms and neck.
Oh! Heart cramming into her mouth, she jumped up and cast a wild look in the direction from which Luke's screams had come. "Luke!" she called. "Luke! What's going on?" Chad cried. He and Jasper had bolted to their feet. Weapons drawn, the three guards were hurrying over just as Luke clawed his way out of the grainy half-light. His eyes were shiny as headlamps.
"What is it, kid?"
one of the guards demanded as Luke stumbled over. "Where's—" "By the stream! I think he—" "He had a heart attack or something. He just kind of grabbed his chest and..." Luke's face crumpled. "I don't know CPR."
"Aw, shit. He ain't breathing. Shit. All right, come on, come on. Quit bawling and show us, kid."
Slinging his weapon onto his shoulders, the guard gave Luke a push.
"We're going to have to carry him,"
he said to the others as they hurried off, all talking at once.
"Where the hell is the flashlight?" "What do you mean you dropped it, kid?" "Jesus, I told him to knock off those damn smokes after he run out of pills for his ticker."
Cindy waited until the guards had disappeared into the trees, then looked at Chad and Jasper.
"Luke knows CPR," she said quietly. "Tom taught us, remember?"
"He didn't teach me," Jasper said. "You're too little." Cindy saw that Chad now had the still hissing coffee pot in one hand.
"Something's going down."
"Cindy, Jasper," Chad said. "Grab a couple rocks from around the fire. Don't burn yourselves."
"They have guns,"
Cindy protested as she grabbed a sharp-edged stone as big as her hand.
"Maybe not for long,"
Chad said, interposing his body and squaring off so Cindy and Jasper were behind him.
"Anything really bad happens, you just run."
From the trees came muffled cries, a sharp
"What?"
then a deep, throaty growl and the bap of a handgun that made Cindy jump.
"Oh, shit," Chad was breathing hard. "I can't tell if those are animals or Chucky's."
Cindy pulled in a squeaky inhale that she stifled with a hand. More sounds now, the clatter of rocks, a strange yipping cry, a crack.
"Jeez, that was an Uzi. Maybe you guys better get out of here," Chad said. "We stay together."
Cindy's heart was fluttering like the wings of a trapped parakeet.
"I'm not leaving you to get eaten. It can't be Chucky's or animals. Luke's still alive."
"Hey!" Jasper pointed to where the guards and Luke had disappeared.
"Look!"
What first emerged from the trees was a gigantic gray-white wolf, as big as a warg in that battle from the second Lord of the Rings movie, only not as ugly and with no snarling, sword-wielding orc either. Still, Cindy gasped, took a step back.
"No way I can run fast enough. Oh, man, that thing's huge,"
Chad said, his voice shaky.
"Where?"
Two figures trotted out next. The first to pull together was Luke, weighted down with rifles.
"Luke!"
Cindy started forward, relief singing in her veins. She'd had visions of Luke with his throat torn out and blood splashed over his chest.
"What's—"
She skidded to a stop as a second person came into view. An older girl in a queer camo get-up with an Uzi in her hands and a bolt-action rifle over her shoulder.
"Hey, haven't I seen her somewhere before?"
"Who are you?" she asked. "My name's Alex," the girl said. "Who are you guys? How come you're with Finn?" At that, all four of them, Cindy, Luke, Jasper, and Chad, looked at one another before turning to the girl. Cindy opened her mouth, but Luke beat her to it.
"Alex?"
Luke said.
"Tom's Alex?"
The girl halted in mid-stride, astonishment leaking over her face.
You know Tom?"
One hand went to her throat.
"You've seen Tom? You've seen him?"
"Sure, we all did," Jasper said, and Cindy could have strangled the stupid kid. "Tom was our friend. He helped us."
"Did?"
Alex paled. Her green eyes went suddenly glittery and wet.
"Was?"
"Yes." Luke tossed Cindy an unhappy glance before turning back. She knew just how he felt.
"I'm sorry, Alex," Luke said helplessly, "but Tom's dead."
Chapter 108. "I don't see them," Tom said. He and Chris had taken it fast, urging their horses down the shimmering cut of a trail that wound through a dense grill of hardwood and evergreen to the lookout that perched southeast on a broad basalt plateau 100 yards up from the hastily erected abattoir. Now, standing in the lookout's cab some 75 feet above ground, he lowered his binoculars.
Overhead, the brightest stars shone from deep, dark cobalt, but to the east, a smear of silver smudged the horizon. To his right, clouds smoked over a light green basketball of a moon balanced on the rim of trees. With the diminished snowpack and large swatches of bare ground, they no longer had the advantage of reflected moonlight. Shadows wavered over this southern approach. Bad luck for them, good for Finn.
Gonna be daylight soon. It's the damn clouds. Glass it south and wait for it, Jarvis said. They're already over the rise. Can't make out if they got weapons. There, dead ahead. You see them?
Yeah. The shadows rolled aside as if someone had peeled away a blanket, and then, through his binoculars, Tom saw something that reminded him of columns of black ants swarming over a checked tablecloth. With the fitful light, it was impossible to tell just how many they were talking about here, but he guessed there must be at least a couple hundred changed. The sizes seemed right. These were kids, moving nimbly and swiftly in a relentless tide, coming on fast, spilling down the hill. At that pace, they'd be here in less than 30 minutes, just in time for the first glimmerings of sun. Smart. His men will be able to see what they're shooting at. The light would work to Tom's advantage later, however. The trick would be keeping Finn's men in the square just long enough. 10-15 minutes, that's all. Hey, Chris said, standing at Tom's right elbow. Top of the hill? See those horses? I see them. Impossible to miss. The horses were just moving over the crest. He'd known some would ride. Melly, Finn, a few of Finn's men. What he had not expected was the gleam of overwhites.
That's them. The altered changed I told you about. The ones in white? On horseback?
Jarvis sounded startled.
I know horses don't react quite as bad, but... my God, there have to be at least 20 or 30 of them. If they're so good at fighting, why aren't they leading the charge? Chris asked. Wouldn't you want your best guys on point?
Well, not if you want them to stay your best guys. This is like the Mongol hordes. Tom could see men now, too, to the extreme right and left, broader in the chest and clad in what looked like soft gray and white winter camouflage. From the occasional wink of metal, he knew the men were armed, and some, he thought, might be carrying bulkier munitions. He just couldn't tell what yet. Let the grunts take the bullets.
Our grandkids is cannon fodder.
Jarvis was silent a moment.
Spooky the way they move, how quiet they are.
Another brief silence.
How's he controlling them?
Don't have a clue, Tom said, still straining to pick up Finn and failing. Until sunrise or the riders were closer, Finn, probably all in black on that gelding, would be virtually invisible. Instead, he trained his binoculars beyond, sweeping the distant knolls and flatlands.
Maybe he gets into their heads.
Chris's ragged voice was hushed.
You said he has to be giving them something because of their eyes.
What if they can hear his thoughts?
I can sort of buy that with the altered ones. Tom slowly panned right to left. The night was starting to unravel and gray, and he shifted his gaze slightly off-center the way he might if trying to glimpse a distant galaxy.
God, please make them be there.
But that doesn't explain the others. He stopped as he spied an orange flicker in the middle distance.
Got him. West, near the tree line. There's a stream there, still iced up in parts, but flowing pretty good now. That's where I would put my camp.
He looked over at Chris. Good a time as any to send Prue and your guys. They can be there pretty fast. Nodding, Chris tugged out his radio just as Jarvis said,
Tom, you see those guys breaking off from the main body?
Yeah, I do.
Four men on horseback were storming past the advance line of changed. Still too dim for him to make out well, but he was getting a very bad vibe.
What?
Jarvis asked.
Are they doing?
Chapter 109. Over the past few minutes, that push-push-go-go had surged back with a vengeance, knocking the breath from Alex's lungs. From its deep cave, the monster seethed the way a worm eeled under the thin skin of a too-ripe fruit.
Running out of time.
Her aunt always said that time healed, yet time had only brought her more people to care about and lose. The sobs she kept swallowing back tried climbing her throat. All she wanted was to howl, break something, maybe shoot someone.
Stop, Alex. You're no different from these kids. Focus. There's still Wolf and Peter. Chris might be in Rule 2. You have to help them. Tom wouldn't want to see you like this. Be strong for him.
Take this. Leaning down from the saddle, Alex handed the Springfield to Luke. Without a rifle scabbard, the more compact Uzi would be easier to handle. Tucking the guard's pistol, a blued Colt Gold Cup 45, into the small of her back, she slotted an extra magazine for both weapons into her cargo pants. She felt a mild pang of unease that she didn't have time to search for a Glock, then pushed that aside. The Colt would do just as much damage.
Just remember to flip the safety.
Still, not having a Glock felt like a bad omen.
Between this and what's in the wagons, you have plenty of food and firepower.
For a fight? Luke said, his voice tight.
If it comes down to that.
The day was coming on fast. In the first wash of silver spreading over the eastern horizon, there was enough light to see how pinched and white Luke's face was.
It doesn't have to. Take the tents, a couple wagons, and get out of here.
Alex, there are 30 of us. We'll be easy to follow, easy to catch again. There was no sugarcoating this.
You'd rather wait for Finn?
But why can't you stay? Cindy's glasses blazed with reflected firelight.
They're Chuckies. What do you care? We're normal. We need you more. Tom would never leave. We're supposed to believe that there are good Chuckies. And Peter, he's only half a Chucky, so what? Why are you taking his side?
Whoa, Luke said.
Cindy, calm down. What if I don't want to be calm? This is like helping terrorists. Just because Wolf didn't kill you, Alex, doesn't mean he's good. It's like you've been brainwashed or something.
And you might be right, Alex said, but Peter is a friend. I have other friends in Rule. Wolf saved my life when he didn't have to. That counts for something, and I have to deal with it right now. I have to go to Rule and try to do something, anything, or a lot more people are going to die, including kids like you.
If I can take Finn by surprise, if I can stop or kill him...
And where was that coming from? Then he won't come after you again. Everyone wins. She paused.
Pretty much. And what about all those other Chuckies?
Cindy asked.
They're at least 4 miles away. Most are on foot. Plenty of time.
Well, the white Chuckies have horses, Jasper said, and then, as if in afterthought, of course, if you kill Finn, the network kind of falls apart, and they might not work so well. The signal intensity will degrade for sure.
What? What do you...
Alex began, but then Cindy interrupted.
So we keep running, is what you're saying?
The younger girl's lips were quivering now.
You're just leaving us?
Alex felt a twang of impatience.
Oh, for God's sake, yes, you run. You're not 3 years old. Step up to take care of yourselves, because right now there's no one else.
Even if I stayed, I am one person. I'm not that much older than you, and I've got... She bit back the possible words, cancer, a monster, before any could jump out of her mouth.
God, Alex, calm down. She's just a kid.
Closing her eyes, she took a steadying breath, then looked down at the teary-eyed girl.
I'm sorry, Cindy. Maybe Tom would stay. That doesn't make him right and me wrong. It makes us different. I wish...
She pushed back the sudden choke.
I wish he was alive so we could argue about it. But don't think this is easy or that I'm not scared to death.
No one said anything for a long moment. Then Luke stepped closer.
What if we wait for you? Tom would want us to. We pack up and move, say, a mile or so west into the woods.
This was the mountain again, the day of the zap, when she was saddled with Ellie and terrified out of her mind. She didn't want all this on her. Yet if Ellie hadn't been there, would she have tried so hard? Ever left the Waccamaw? Every step she'd taken since the zap had been because of someone else. She might still be lost, if not for Ellie and Tom and Chris, even Wolf. All those connections led her out of those woods from a very black place and pulled her from the brink of a leap where there was nothing and no one waiting but death.
Tom said we saved each other.
She ran her eyes over the upturned faces.
Maybe he was saving me for this.
If I can, she said to Luke, I'll be back. We'll figure this out. But don't wait to a quick kick of pain, a fireball behind her eyes.
Deep in her mind, the monster flexed, teased awake, and she could feel it stretching, trying to muscle open that box. She blinked, and it was as if the shutter of a camera suddenly opened a third eye, and she's behind those eyes again, in that body she's beginning to think might be a boy's, and in the heart of the push, push, go, go, high on a horse, dressed in white, the red storm on the left, and the others screaming, go, 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 let me go, silently streaming over patchy snow, flowing with the push, push, go, go of the red storm, breathing in the ripe meat smell it wants, he wants, she craves. In the distance is a high hill and the stark outlines of a tower. Then a shift into and through many eyes, a shimmer. And now, closer still, push, push, go, 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 go. She is looking through a tangled curtain of matted hair. This body is another boy, and he is wild at the aroma of salt and meat, of prey dead ahead and just up that hill in the tower. Go, go, push, push. I want, I want, I want, I need. Push, push, go, go. Two rumbling booms suddenly cannoned like distant thunder. Some of the kids let out startled cries. Snapping back behind her own eyes, Alex saw two faint yellow-orange candles shoot into a pewter sky due north. The flares faded fast, swallowed by distance, the coming day to her left, and the gleam of the moon low on the western horizon. That tower. That's where the changed boy was focused. The tower and men. Meet. Go, Alex. Good luck, Luke said. We'll watch for you. Come back. She wanted to say she would, but all those words hung in her throat. Stay safe. Then she spurred her horse as Buck sprang after and galloped for Rule. Chapter 110 Tom wasted 10 minutes piecing it together. By then, Jarvis was on the ground and Chris was trotting down the last flight. On the final landing, 20 feet above the ground, Tom turned a troubled look back. Those men should have been on them, or very close. A fast horse can cover a lot of ground in no time flat, and yet, glassing the plane through breaks in the trees, he saw they'd dismounted, maybe, he chewed his lower lip, a half mile, working on, Tom? Chris, just below, what is it? You see something? Yeah, but their backs are to me. Can't tell what, as a cloud finally drifted aside to bathe the plane with moonlight, he raised his binoculars. Why send only 4? Tom! Chris's voice was sharp. What? Oh, Jesus. Alarm ripped through Tom's gut as he finally understood. 2 men were kneeling, and now he could see what they balanced on their shoulders. RPGs! Whirling, Tom planted his hands on the metal guardrail. RPGs! RP... Chapter 111
Jesus Christ, kid, the bald boy snarled.
With dawn filtering through low-slung evergreens, Ellie saw the creep's hair was growing back around spidery scabs.
Give me the damn gun! No!
Ellie hugged the savage to her chest. This was so embarrassing. All around, kids, most older and a few younger, were all big eyes and sniggery mouths. To her right, a tiny girl with a froth of fine, nearly white hair was cringing, like Ellie had sneezed and gotten her all boogery.
It's my gun! Jaden lets me!
This isn't Jaden's wagon, and I don't care!
Creep totally freaked her out. All those eyebrow hoops and that safety pin crusted with old blood through his right earlobe, not to mention the tongue stud. It was just plain sick, like the kid got off on deciding what part to stab next, as if life wasn't bad enough already.
Now hand it over, the boy said.
Lucian, leave her alone.
It was the thin, tired-looking girl, Sarah, who was driving the swaying wagon as they jounced over humped ice and sparse snow.
She's not hurting anybody.
Yet,
Lucian said.
You want that gun to go off?
It's safetied,
Ellie said.
Sensing her distress, Mina clambered to her feet and pushed her snout into Ellie's stomach, while Jet and Ghost also struggled up to see what was the matter. That started a general heaving and jostling of the other dogs, which staggered and bumped kids, who started up with complaints and blah, blah, blah. Maybe they'd let her walk. That would certainly solve the whole gun thing. Exasperated, she pushed Mina to a sit.
My finger's not even in the guard. What do you think, it's going to go off on its own?
All right, listen, Sarah said, hoeing the horse to a halt. Sarah's expression reminded Ellie of teachers she'd like to forget. Sympathetic about her dad, but always saying stuff like, we can't have that kind of behavior in class.
Give Lucian the gun, please. I can't drive with you guys arguing and a loaded gun pointed at my back.
It's aimed at the sky, Ellie said.
Well, trees. Dense forest hemmed this snaky curlicue of a road. Limbs jutted like fingers trying to lace. They were making lousy time. She bet they weren't more than 3-4 miles out. If they needed to turn around or move fast, they were sunk. Jaden was having a heart attack. Ellie saw him in the driver's box of that first wagon, his head going every which way, trying to watch everywhere at once.
Even if it went off, which it won't, she said, it wouldn't hurt anybody.
I don't give a fuck. Don't make me come back there, kid, Lucian warned.
The other kid's eyes were saucers. A bunch of boys started in with the elbow jabs.
Whoa, F-bomb.
Oh, why had Tom put her in this wagon? She should have hopped right out and run over to Jaden's.
But I know what I'm doing, she said,
as one of the boys on horseback eased to their wagon, ducking beneath branches as he did so.
Problem here?
The boy, about Jaden's age, had dark, curly hair, kind of like Tom's, which was wavy and thick. Ellie thought he even looked a bit like Tom, and then saw why in this boy's eyes, which were smudged with purple and sad. Like Tom's, even when he said he was happy to see her. Ellie knew why, too. Tom hurt all the time because of Alex. Ellie only wished she knew how to make that better.
Maybe if I love him enough, hug him enough.
We're fine, Greg, Lucian said, his tone like a boy with one eye on the playground monitor and the other on the kid whose butt he wanted to kick.
Yeah, I guess that's why the wagon stopped, Greg said in an unimpressed uh-huh way that made Ellie bite her cheek to keep back the snicker. He cut the girl a look.
Sarah, I said we got this.
Heaving to his feet, Lucian stepped onto the flatbed, brushing past feathery branches to wade through dogs and kids. Towering over Ellie like a giant killer, Lucian jabbed a finger into Greg's chest.
This is my wagon. This kid's got a gun. I want it. And you're not in charge here, Gregor.
Calm down, Lucian.
Sarah looked like a whipped puppy.
Guys, look, let's just settle this and get going, okay?
But it's safety, right? So what's the harm?
Greg said.
Yeah,
Ellie said. This Greg kid was okay.
If we get into trouble, we'll need every gun we've got.
Oh, bullshit, Lucian snorted. We get into trouble, ain't no little girl 22 gonna save our butts.
Fine, Ellie shot back. So if I'm not gonna save your butt, you mind if I save mine?
That got everyone nudging elbows and whispering again.
I don't care, you're not my friends.
She glowered up at Lucian.
What's your problem?
A very good question, Greg said. Greg, Lucian growled, don't push me, man.
Or what? You going to kill me now? You had your shot, Greg said.
She should give it,
the white-haired girl suddenly piped in that lisping sing-song every kid knew.
Okay, but don't blame me.
She had to be, what, 6? The girl clutched a Lala Loopsy doll with a spray of fuchsia curls.
My mommy said guns kill people.
About half the kids gave solemn nods, but a trio of boys shrugged, and one elfish older kid with big ears said,
I don't see what's the big deal. I wish I had a gun.
Greg, Sarah said, still with that nervous whipped puppy look, this isn't going to change what's happened.
You weren't locked in a cell, Sarah, Greg said,
but he was looking at Lucian.
You weren't spit on and punched. You didn't clean chunks of dead kid from a church floor or shovel horse shit with your bare hands.
Whoa, no wonder Chris left Rule.
The way Greg and Lucian were eyeing each other, she had a terrible feeling that neither needed much of an excuse.
her closet voice.
Don't make trouble, Ellie.
Fine. Look, I'm giving it.
Fuming, she watched Lucian shuck the round in the chamber, then work the bolt and empty the savage's magazine.
There you go. Lucian had this big, nasty smirk all over his stupid face.
Slipping her bullets into a pocket, he handed back the rifle.
We get where we're going, you can have the bullets back. And Greg?
Lucian stomped for the driver's box.
Thanks for your concern, man. Now fuck off.
Lucian, Sarah said. We are so not living on the same farm.
Probably wouldn't give back her bullets either. Turning, she reached out to touch Greg's leg.
He's kind of a jerk, huh?
Fucking heard that,
Lucian said.
Yeah, like seriously,
Greg said with a perfectly straight face. She almost cracked up.
I didn't mean to get you in trouble.
You didn't. Don't worry about it,
Greg said, but didn't smile. As Sarah snapped the reins and their wagon started up, he let them pull ahead.
See you later.
Okay, so Greg seemed all right.
But I still wish Tom was here, and Chris. I want to go home.
Dragging an arm across her eyes, she slouched into her parka, digging her chin under the zipper until the collar was up around her nose, and glared down at her boots.
I want my daddy, and Grandpa Jack, and Tom, and Alex.
The dogs had settled down, although Mina kept dropping her chin on Ellie's lap.
Quit it,
she said, shoving the animal away.
I'm fine.
It's really safer,
the white-haired girl said.
My mommy... Yeah, well, your mom's dead, and so is mine, so shut up!
As soon as the words dropped out, she cringed, and her closet voice shouted,
Ellie!
That wasn't nice, said the elfish boy.
I know.
Pulling in a deep breath, she turned to the little girl.
Sorry, that was really mean.
The girl's eyes were moist blue pools. Her lips, delicate as rose petals, quivered as she dropped her face into her doll's crazy, silly hair. Would she ever learn to keep her big mouth shut? Laying down the savage, Ellie put an arm around the little kid's heaving shoulders. To her astonishment, the tears she'd held back streamed over her cheeks, too.
Don't cry. I just get mad sometimes.
I get mad all the time,
the elfish boy said.
I miss my mommy.
The white-haired girl used her doll's hair to wipe her eyes.
I keep waiting for things to get better, only they never do.
They will,
Ellie said, trying to jam in a whole bunch of oh wow she really didn't feel. Grandpa Jack always said to look on the bright side, only everywhere Ellie turned, it was still dark, even in the middle of the day.
Engage brain before tongue, her dad always said.
Remember how awful it was in the beginning when everything went crazy? It's still bad now,
said one of the elbow jab boys. His buddies nodded.
Not where we're going. We have cows and sheep, and there are lakes. Hannah knows about plants, and I catch lots of fish.
You fish?
The elfish boy looked impressed.
Can I come?
Too late, she remembered Eli and Rock, still down there somewhere.
Never fishing there again.
But she said,
sure.
All the kids were looking now and smiling like she'd brought in this great show and tell. She gave the little girl a squeeze.
Really, things will be great.
From somewhere far behind came two thundery rumbles. Every hair rose on Ellie's arms. Gasping, she sat straight up and turned to look the way they'd come, as did all the children and the dogs, too. The wagons stopped rolling, the horses ceased clopping. While the forest was still gloomy with dissolving shadows, slashes of bright light showed through the trees to the east. Due south, Ellie caught brief, bright pillows of pulsing orange light.
Oh,
Sarah's hand was over her mouth. Beside her, Lucian had gone so pale his stubble looked like dirt.
Oh, God,
Sarah said. The dogs began to bark. All around, kids were jabbering.
Wow, what was that? Did you see that? Is it a fire?
At her elbow, the white-haired girl had her hands clapped to her ears and squeaked over and over again.
What was that? What was that? What was that?
Explosions! The elfish boy's voice rose over the general gabble. Like bombs!
Tom does bombs.
She was trembling. So much fear and dread coiled through her body that when Mina suddenly let out a frenzied, furious volley of barks, she almost sprang out of the wagon.
Mina, stop!
Twisting, she buried her face in the dog's neck, not really registering right away that the dog was wildly trying to pull away.
Please, God, please, not Tom, not Tom, not... Hey, look.
It was the white-haired girl, her voice now a wavering whisper no more substantial than a faint breeze, and so soft, Ellie was the only one who heard.
Everybody, I don't want to look anymore.
She kept her head down. It never gets better. Everyone dies. When Mina suddenly growled, Ellie looked up and said, No, me... and stopped. Everyone else, everyone, that is, except for the now growling dogs and the white-haired girl, still stared back the way they'd come, and they were all talking at once. Many kids had begun to cry, although above the din she thought she heard the old doctor's voice drifting back from Jaden's wagon. What is it, Daisy? Where? Jaden, son, I think we got trouble. I think...
Oh, boy, I think he's right.
Their dogs and the little girl were riveted to the trees on their left. The little girl was so terrified she'd stopped crying. Barely daring to breathe, Ellie inched her eyes west, away from a new day, and saw dark silhouettes slip from behind tree trunks that in such bad light you might mistake for fence posts or dead trees. Except posts don't move. Trees didn't have arms or legs or teeth. Chapter 112. In the instant after Tom's warning shout, the world hiccuped. Something kicked Chris in the back. There was a brief sensation of hurtling through air. Then there was nothing. No impact, no dreams this time around, or nightmares either, quite possibly because he was living one. But time lurched like a really old movie missing the middle reel, the story dropping out. The next thing he knew, he was face down, hands clawing for purchase, blindly worming his way over a still-hissing debris field of splintered wood, twisted metal, molten glass. In the distance, he heard the dong-bong of the church bell sounding the alarm. When had that started up? The air boiled with screams and wails. Someone was bellowing, What? Much closer, someone was moaning. After another second, he understood the moans were his. He tasted blood at the back of his throat. His stinging face was wet with melted ice and snow, but his hand came away red, and he thought, I can see this. I can see color. Because there was light. Time. Time, how much had passed, how much. The world was both bright and murky. Intermittent black clouds smoked over sky that was denim overhead and a lighter turquoise to the east from the first spokes of sunlight. The air stank of spent fuel, burning wood, scorched metal, and overdone Sunday roast. Those clouds! Smoke! The sparse pines on this plateau were torches. Behind and off to his right came the crackle and sputter of another larger fire. Got to get out of here. Rolling, he looked toward the tower 100 feet away. All that remained was a gnarled ruin of skeletal struts and one remaining flight of steps leading nowhere. One horse, Jarvis's, was down, its belly a ragged blast crater of mangled entrails. Knight, his blood bay, was still on his feet. Tom's dun mare was in the trees. One hand pressed to his head, the other clutched around a rifle. A man tottered and screamed, What? Jarvis! Staggering to his feet, Chris coughed, moaned again as his cracked ribs sent knifing jabs through his chest. Jarvis! Where's Tom? We're here! To his right, a tangle of wire mesh moved. Chris saw first the bore of the Bravo still in its scabbard, and then Tom, on hands and knees, struggling against a pile of debris. Uh-oh. Wobbling over, Chris dragged away mesh and smashed wood. His heart turned over when he saw the spike of metal sticking out of a star of blood and ripped cloth from a spot high on Tom's left thigh, just beneath his hip. How bad? Chris dropped to his knees. He reached a hand, then snatched it back, afraid he'd make something worse. Don't know. Don't think it's that deep. Doesn't feel broken, and it's not pumping. Help me up. Tom suppressed a groan as Chris got a shoulder under and boosted him up. Hurts like hell, Tom said, his face screwed against pain. Can you walk? Can you ride? Yeah. Hissing,
Tom took a limping experimental step, and then another. I'll make it. We're both lucky we're not dead from the pressure. Tom stopped, sniffed, then said, Oh, shit. What? Chris said, but Tom was already lurching for the edge of the basalt plateau. Smoke jetted like the exhalations of a subterranean dragon from somewhere just below. Wincing with every jarring step, Chris caught up and squinted down. In science, they'd studied Mount St. Helens, and Chris remembered the way the blast flattened all those trees. This wasn't quite as bad, but it was close. The blazing abatey looked as if it had been smashed by a giant's boot. Nearby trees had toppled. He could see where snow had either been vaporized instantly by the heat or melted.
4 men, 2 RPGs.
Chris's eyes roamed the wreckage. The legs were easy to identify, as were the half-torsos and
heads.
He hadn't meant to say anything, it just came out. The heads were very distinct. A few looked like 8-balls without the white. No skin, no hair. Others had cracked open like walnuts to release red and pink sludge.
Tom, I see.
Yeah, come on. Turning, Tom started in a fast hobble for the trees. We've lost a lot of time. Going to be full daylight soon. We need to get to town before the changed get here. Jarvis, Tom called to the old man, still turning his circles. Come on, we have to...
What?
Jarvis whirled so fast a foamy line of spit flew. His eyes, crimson with broken capillaries, started from their sockets. Blood trickled from his nose and one ear. He shot the bolt of his rifle.
Stay away from me! Stay away! Whoa, whoa, whoa!
Tom held up both hands. Jarvis, calm down, man. We've got to go. The change...
Who? What?
Jarvis screamed.
What? What?
What's wrong with him? Chris asked. Probably the pressure wave. Scrambles some people up.
Jarvis, Tom tried again. Listen to me, man. It's okay, but we have to go. We have to...
Suddenly, Tom stiffened and turned back toward the plateau and the smoking tower.
What?
Chris asked.
What do you...
Then over the crackle of flames, Chris heard it too. The sharp snap of brush, the stomp of boots on rock. Deep in the smoke, something moved. Something dark blue. For a disorienting moment, Chris thought the smoke was pulling together, changing color, becoming parkas and then jeans, and then he realized that what he saw were changed, a lot of them, surging up the rise only 100 feet away, materializing like invaders teleported from a distant planet.
Chris! Tom clamped a hand on his arm and tugged. Come on! Don't look! Just go!
Oh, my God! Chris was paralyzed, rooted to the spot. Jarvis was screaming again.
What? What? What?
And Chris was thinking,
I don't know, I don't know, I don't...
Chris! Tom snapped him around so quickly, Chris had to clutch Tom's arms to keep his feet.
I said don't look at them! Get on your horse, Chris! Get on your horse now!
Oh, okay,
Chris gasped. He took off in a stumbling run, Tom crowding behind, urging him on. Snatching his bay's reins, Chris tried to boost to his saddle, but his feet wouldn't work.
Come on, he heard himself plead. Come on, come on, come!
He heard them, boots stirring debris, kicking wood, crunching glass,
getting louder.
His back prickled.
Coming closer. Don't look, don't look, don't!
But then he did snatch a glance.
Stupid!
And a nail of terror jabbed his heart. The changed, so many, too many, were fanning out, spilling over the plateau, charging right for them.
Chris! No!
Tom was already whipping his horse around.
Don't look! Come on! You've got time! Just don't panic!
Too late.
Socking his boot in a stirrup, he grabbed leather and swam to an awkward half-sit on his saddle.
Tried not to look. Couldn't help it.
The changed, these children of rule, were less than 50 feet away. In the coming day, you could see their mouths open in silent snarls, and their eyes so wide, so wild. No weapons, only teeth and clawed fingers and...
Don't look, Chris!
No voice but his own, one that wanted him to live.
Move or you're dead!
But it was fascinating, appalling. Awful. Every nightmare come to life, and why deer froze in headlights, and people died at train crossings, and Moses covered his eyes. No one can help but stare at the monster, because horror is a cousin to awe. Chris, no! What are you doing? Chris! Tom shouted at the same time that Jarvis bellowed, What? What? What?
Braying, Knight finally shied, Chris's panic communicating itself to a shocked animal that understood death was a hair's breadth away. The bay reared. Not yet fully seated, Chris let out a strangled cry as the slide started. He felt himself peeling backward. He was falling. He was going to fall into the changed and their arms, and they would get him. They were there. They were home.
Bullying his prancing mare alongside, Tom snatched at Knight's bridle. Chris, set your damn knees, grab his mane or withers, and get on! Get on!
Sobbing out of breath, Chris scrambled for a handhold. Knight's terrified eyes rolled. His head snapped back and slammed Chris's face. The blow was terrific, so hard that Chris's vision blacked. Stunned, he lost his grip, began to slump, and then there were hands everywhere, skittering over his left leg and thigh, fingers clutching to pull him off, and he thought, I'm done. An enormous bang came from someplace over his head. The questing hands suddenly fell away. Another bang! To Chris's left, a changed boy slapped both hands to the crater where his nose had been and tumbled back. Still dazed, Chris felt Tom's fingers claw his shoulder. Don't lose it, man! Tom shouted, manhandling Chris onto the saddle. You can't lose it, Chris! Come on! Despite his injury, keeping to his mare only with his knees, Tom had a big black Glock in one hand and Chris's shoulder in the other. Another girl with very long, filthy hair made a lunging grab. Cursing, Tom swung down, stuck the pistol in the girl's face. The changed was so intent on him, she never saw Tom, much less the gun, and bang! Her head shattered, skull and scalp and brains and blood and wild hair flaring in a wet spray. Sit up! Tom roared. Get up, Chris! Sit! The crack of a shot, not from Tom, but to their right. The high zing of a bullet ricocheting off a tree. Bellowing, Jarvis fired again. This time, a changed boy staggered as a red sunburst suddenly flared over his right breast. The line didn't exactly falter, but some changed peeled off, heading for Jarvis, and that gave Chris the precious 2 seconds he needed to slot his foot into his stirrup. All right, come on! Tom shouted. Wheeling, they kicked their horses to a run and bulleted into the trees, heading back for Rule's center 3 miles in their future. It wasn't a mistake, but Chris snagged one last look. 2 changed had their arms around the still bellowing Jarvis. The 3 danced a drunken pirouette. Then another changed joined in, and then more and more.